expecting that to go on to start the song again like it usually does. Sorry about that. Sorry I'm late, folks. I was interacting with someone online and I lost track of time. Anyway, I'm back. Shabbat Shalom, y'all. Here's Mark. We're here to study the word of Elohim today. The scriptures we're looking at are posted in the text. There's one slight change. We're going to be looking at Devarim chapter 23 and verse 21 through Devarim 24 and verse 18. Isaiah chapter 19, the whole chapter. Psalm 139. And also Matthew chapter 5. And we're going to be looking at 27 to 37, actually. But that's what's there is what's actually posted at messianic.ws. So that's the actual text we're supposed to be looking at. But I wanted to look at 27 to 29 to give us a lead into 30, because jumping into 30 is like in the middle of an argument. So anyway, I forgot to start my recording. Let me do that. Here we go. All right, so we're on. And like I said, we're looking at Deuteronomy 23, 21 through 24, 18, Isaiah 19, Psalm 139, and Matthew chapter 5, verse 27 to 37 today. We hope that this will be a blessing to you all. We start every week with the Shema. The Shema is the central truth of everything that there is. Everything. Because Yehovah is the truth of everything that there is. And the Shema goes like this, and I'll give you the translation when we're done, too. It goes, Shema Israel, Yehovah Eloheinu, Yehovah Echad, Baruch Shem Kevod, Malchuto, Leolam Vayed. Hear, O Israel, Yehovah our Elohim, Yehovah is one. Blessed be he whose glorious kingdom is forever and ever. See, Yehovah is one. And so, everything that there is has its source in Yehovah's word. Okay? He created from nothing everything that there is. I mean, the material world, the material that you see in the world, is not Yehovah. But Yehovah is right there with every molecule. He's still into existence. Okay, he's spoken into existence from nothing in the first 6 days of creation. That's what we'll see when we get to Genesis chapter 1 in March. But he must have kept speaking it into existence, okay, because his word also sustains that creation. So everything came from his mind and was spoken into existence by his word and keeps being spoken into existence. Nothing that exists outside of its relationship to Yehovah. So when we say Yehovah is one, we see that he is the central truth of everything. Okay? That's how I see it anyway. I could be wrong, but I seriously doubt it. Father, thank you for bringing us together today. We bless you right now, Father, for giving us your word and for giving us the opportunity to become more and more like your son by studying your word. We want to be as Messiah is, and we know that we're going to do that in our resurrected bodies, but the more we become like him in our mindset and in our attitudes and actions, the more like him we become, quite literally. And so, Father, we ask that you would put your spirit on everyone in this room today while we're studying this word so that we can file into our brains in a very logical and systematic manner understanding of your word so that we can become more like your son. And also, Father, that we could shed whatever it is, any untruth that comes out today, any admixture of error. We don't want to be deceived in any way. And we ask that you do that for us, because we might not see the deception right away. We ask that you would just flush it from us, like flushing stuff down the toilet, because that's what the deception is. That's what lies are. We don't want any lies today. Help us to assimilate all the truth that we hear and all of the truth that we get from both this end of the microphone and from that end out there, because I'm looking for lots and lots of participation today. In Yeshua's name I ask it, and I thank you for it, Father. Amen ve'omen. Okay, we're going to be looking at Devarim. By the way, I don't have my Bible program up on the computer here yet. Let me break that out. We're going to be looking at Devarim chapter 23 first. And there we are, right at Devarim chapter 23. I'll move down to verse 19, and we'll start reading there. And it goes like this. Thou shalt not lend upon usury to thy brother, usury of money, usury of victuals, usury of anything that is lent upon usury. Unto a stranger thou mayest lend upon usury, but unto thy brother thou shalt not lend upon usury, that Jehovah Elohecha may bless thee in all that thou settest thine hand to in the land whither thou goest to possess it. When thou shalt vow a vow unto Jehovah Elohecha, thou shalt not slack to pay it, for Jehovah Elohecha will surely require it of thee, and it would be sin in thee. But if thou shalt forbear to vow, it shall be no sin in thee. That which is gone out of thy lips thou shalt keep and perform, even a freewill offering, according as thou hast vowed unto Jehovah Elohecha, which thou hast promised with thy mouth. When thou comest into thy neighbor's vineyard, then thou mayest eat grapes, thy fill at thine own pleasure, but thou shalt not put any in thy vessel to carry off with you, is the implication. When thou comest into the standing corn of thy neighbor, then thou mayest pluck the ears with thine hand, but thou shalt not move a sickle unto thy neighbor's standing corn. Again, so that you can carry it off for yourself. And here we go, my commentary on 19 and 20. And we're going to get a break after looking at these two verses. Usury is from the Hebrew root, nun, shin, kaf, nashach. To us, it means exceedingly high interest on debt, when we talk about usury. In the Hebrew language, it means demanding any interest on a debt. In the Paleo-Hebrew pictographs, the nun signifies a seed sprout, which has the idea of continuation. The shin represents the two front teeth biting something, and the kaf represents an open palm. In this case, I believe the word means to continually eat out a man's substance, open hand outstretched to receive more than your due. The bend and curve in the open hand and the kaf can also be seen as bending one's will to another's purpose, which is the wicked end of usury. It was forbidden to extract usury from a fellow Hebrew to make a profit from a brother's need. It was okay to profit from a pagan's need, but not from a brother's. Today's bankers, who are dominated worldwide by the Rothschild family and their intermingled banking partners, don't pay any heed to Torah, exacting interest from everyone, regardless their heritage. It makes no difference if the mark, he's not a customer, he's the one being conned, is Hebrew or heathen. If the mark is Hebrew or heathen, all pay usury. And it has become truly usurious in anyone's estimation. First of all, the Cobra Bill of 1987, if my memory serves, made it so that banks and other lending institutions get fully reimbursed by the Treasury for all loans contracted at midnight of the day that the mark signs the contract. Remember, if you go into the bank to get a loan, you're the mark, okay? And I'm going to explain why you're the mark in just a second. This means they get paid 100% of all of the loan at the midnight following your signature on the contract. Okay? Now, that means that they get paid 100% profit in only 3 years of minimum payments. And the principal has barely been touched. And very often, if not always, they will advertise a low interest rate, like 12.5% on a credit card. That's a very low interest rate on a credit card, by the way. But that isn't the actual annual yield, because they will compound that usury monthly. What that means is the 12.5% is divided by 12, or roughly 1.05%, and charge that the first month. If you borrow $1,000 at this rate, you will owe slightly less than $1,010.50 after the first month. Now watch this. If you get a no payments for NX months, whatever it happens to be, n to the xth power, okay, so whatever the number is times itself 12 times or whatever, the interest still accrues during those months at the monthly compounded rate. If you did a 12-month deferment of payments, by the end of the 12-month term, you will owe $1,000 times 1.041667 12 times. Or, listen to this now, at the end of 12 months, if you haven't made a payment, you will owe $1,632 and just less than 10 cents. Before you make your first payment, exactly 63.209% more than you actually borrowed before you make the first payment. Okay? If you enter into a 12-month same as cash deal and you pay them on the 11th month and the 30th day or the 31st day, you pay just what you borrowed, okay? And that's the chance that they're taking. But the chance that you're taking is that you're not going to pay that thing off at the end of that 11 months, and therefore you're going to get to pay the interest rate starting the day after. And you will have accrued 63% interest on that $1,000 or whatever that you borrowed, okay? It's usurious, absolutely usurious. Now, it says 12.5%, but it's compounded monthly, and therefore it turns into 63%. Okay? Okay, so, and the rate continues to accrue on that debt until you pay all the interest and principal, which at the monthly minimums will take upwards of 6 years. Actually, I've looked at my bill from Chase card, and it said that if I was to pay the thing off in 3 years, making so much of I could pay it off in 3 years, or if I made just the monthly minimum payments, it would take me 20 years to pay the debt. Okay? That's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. And the monthly minimums are incredibly low. Okay. And if you miss a payment or pay it late, they charge you a fee, usually $35 to $40. And that gets added to the note, and you pay interest on it as well. Okay, so you got to make your payments on time. If you got a credit card, you have to make the payments on time because they're just adding to your debt. Okay, they don't take the $39 out of your bank account. They just add it to the debt, and you get to pay interest on that too. And the more of those late fees or missed payment fees that you do, first of all, the more fees you accrue, and you get to pay the debt on them, or the interest on them. And also, that stuff builds up and builds up and builds up. That $39 could end up being like $500-$600 at the end of your term, okay, or more. So you got to be very careful about your debt. You must get it paid off. Okay. It's very important that we get our debt paid as soon as possible if we're holding one, especially usurious credit card debt. Easiest method to do this, and I've told you this many, many, many times, so if you've heard this before, bear with me. Just let it drive into your skull that much more. Easiest method to do this is to gather up all of your credit card bills and pile them in order of amount owed, with the least at the top. Okay, now you take that, you pay all the minimums on all of those cards except for the one on the top, the one that's the lowest balance due. Okay, you take that one and you at least double the payment. Okay, and you do that until you have that card paid off. Then you take that money that you were paying on the first card and you add it to what you were paying on the second. Okay, hopefully you're going to at least double that as well. And you're going to keep doing those things until you've got all of those cards paid off. Now you're going to take that lowest credit card, lowest interest rate credit card, and you're going to hold on to that one and keep it for emergencies And when you have an emergency, you use the thing and then you pay it off right away, okay, first month. Because if you pay it off at the end of the first month, you don't owe any interest. See? It's when when you get to that 31st day or the 32nd day that you start accruing interest. Okay? Get your credit cards paid off. I'm working on it right now. I ran into some pretty major expenses a couple of years ago, and I got whacked in the head with a tree and, you know, doing all the recoup and all that stuff. And so I'm still paying that off. All right? But I'm paying it off little by little by little. Okay? And it's getting knocked down quite well. Anyway, so that's it. You go to you pay off the lowest interest rate, then you go to the next lowest and you add what you were paying on the first bill, and you pay that one off, and then you take everything that you were paying on the first two bills and you add that to the whatever you're paying on the third largest bill, and you keep doing that until you get them all paid off. It takes discipline. Then you have to make sure that you do nothing, you pay for nothing with a credit card. You have to just discipline yourself not to have things that you're used to having that you really don't need. Okay? If you have to stop drinking soda pops or coffee, stop drinking coffee. I don't know if I can do that. But you know what I mean? You got to pay this stuff off and get it taken care of. Do that until, okay, keep all that up until, then use one of those cards for emergency purposes only and pay for everything with cash. If you haven't got the cash, don't borrow it from the usurer, who is, in this case, our Uncle Esau. Those Rothschilds are not racial Yehudim. Okay? Their background, if you go all the way back to their beginnings, you'll find that they were Edomians, like Herod. Okay, what happened was that after the Maccabees sent out Antiochus and they got rid of him, John Hyrcanus, the nephew of Judah Maccabeus, his nephew, John Hyrcanus, became the high priest, and he was also the commanding general of Israel's armed forces. And he conquered Edomia. And he forced them to convert to Judaism. And that's how Herod got to be the king of the Jews, because he was an Edomian Yehudi. Okay? So he got to be the king of the Jews. The Romans picked him and they put him in power. He is an Edomian. And so, by the way, are the Rothschilds. Okay? So that does not have to do with Jews in general. That has to do with these particular bankers. Rothschild, Warburgs, those people. Lehman, Goldman Sachs, those people in America. Okay? Those are all Edomians. They're Edomites. And they're after everybody. Okay. That, by the way, Proverbs chapter 22 and verse 7 says, the rich ruleth over the poor, and the borrower is servant to the lender. And that is absolutely the truth. You must get your credit cards paid off because I must get my credit cards paid off because I am actually acting in an idolatrous manner. Okay? I'm not actually worshiping them, but I have to pay them the tribute that is due only to Yehovah. That's what that is. It's tribute. You're paying tribute to the conqueror. And you let the guy conquer you by signing your name. I mean, he didn't even actually have to fight you. He just had to loan you the money and charge you this usurious interest. Okay, that's what I've got on those first two verses, 21 and 22. I'm sorry, 19 and 20. Are there questions or comments? E-Mark, you have your hand up. And you may take the mic.
Is this working okay? Okay, cool. This is a new computer. Hopefully it'll work. I wanted to comment on the credit card stuff. Just some good information you gave, but just so you guys know the rules on that, there's actually are some advantages in using credit cards, because I do what you were saying, Mark. I pay that off in full. First of all, the bankers who are ripping everyone off, they actually give us 30 days. They give you like a little grace period. So they're actually giving you free money for a little period of time. But that's not the main reason I do it. You have much stronger protections anytime you finance a purchase than you do when you pay cash or with a debit card. And also, if you have the advantages of having a credit card, you can, besides getting the float for a little bit of time, which isn't that big of a deal, but hey, get us so much interest out of us, no matter what we're doing, they're siphoning money away from us. Might as well catch up just a touch. But when you purchase anything, if that product doesn't serve its purpose for any reason whatsoever, you can return that product and dispute the charge. And you can't do that with a debit card. It's a completely different set of rules. There's something called the Truth in Lending Act that allows you to, any financed purchase you have much more protection on than you do on a cash purchase, which is how they treat debit purchases. So that was just the main point, and it was very interesting what you said, and I was going to ask you maybe to revisit that a little bit about the Rothschilds not being of the true branch. So, maybe after other questions you can go back. Okay, I just thought I'd share that with the credit card purchases. We've got to release the mic.
Thank you, Mark. if you have a credit card and you have like those cashback rewards or whatever it is, and you pay the thing off at the end of each month, then it is to your advantage to do that. There are just very few people that actually do that. My father-in-law does it. He has a specific amount of money that he spends, and he uses only this one credit card that gives him like a 1% cash back. And he pays that thing off every month religiously, right at the end, before the due date, always. And by doing that, you can accrue a little bit of extra cash. But in that case, I think you're being the usurer then. I don't know. I would be very careful about that kind of stuff. And E-Mark, you have your hand up again, and you can take the mic again.
I actually disagree. You're not being usurious because you're just not paying interest. They shouldn't be charging interest anyways. I mean, think about it. You go to a store. It used to be you'd go to a local store, and they run a bill for you, and then you pay at the end of the month. It's the same thing. There's no law that says they have to charge interest. They're not giving you interest. I mean, if you're collecting reward points and stuff, fine. That, by the way, there's nothing wrong with that either, because they're paying you gambling that you're going to get into debt and they're going to make money off of the usury. But you're not doing anything wrong, I beg to differ, by accepting terms of paying 30 days after you purchase, because there ain't nothing wrong with that. In fact, that's the way it should be. We should have fair weights and measures, money based on real tangible values such as gold and silver. I think we're supposed to be using that, and then we wouldn't have all this mess to begin with. It's the mess that they created. So anyways, that wasn't the point I was going to make. But I beg to differ strongly. Now, back to the other, and I know probably you're going to come back and say, you know what, Mark, maybe you're right. I hope so. The thing I was going to mention is what I would do if I get into a situation where I do need to finance something, and I have been in those situations, I might be shortly. I don't have a water heater right now. We're working on getting that remedied, and it's going to be expensive because I'm getting a big high-efficiency water heater that supposedly is going to be able to heat my house if we ever get it working. But the point that I was trying to make was I would then take that balance and transfer it over, and here's what you want to do if you can. If you can get it to be a secured loan on your house, which, by the way, I think relates back to Torah in some ways. I'm not going to go down that rabbit trail unless you want to. But what you want to do, if you can get a home equity loan, then you get tax deductions for the interest. And you know what? Interest ain't really a good thing, and y'all doesn't look favorably upon that anyways. So if you're going to pay it, you might as well get a tax deduction, in my opinion, since taxes ain't that great of a thing either. Okay, I release the mic.
Thank you, Mark. yeah, Patty has the right idea. The idea is we need to get back to Sabbath years. We need to get back to Jubilees. We need to get back to following the word of Yehovah. And that is our problem. Okay, we're living in the world and doing this stuff that we ought not to be doing. And, it's just how stuff is. We're, you know, we didn't get into it. We didn't get into this usury on purpose. Okay, we did. You know, we just there was at least I didn't. It was a matter of having to pay bills that had to be paid, and you know I had the credit, and so I did. But I'm wishing I hadn't. I'm wishing I had found some other way to get the cash together. You know, and that's over and above. You know, I got to tell you something. You guys were incredibly, you guys that knew about it, you guys that helped out, you guys were incredibly generous in your gifts so that I could pay those bills and so that I could maintain a home over my head and stuff like that, okay, while I was hurt. I really appreciate all that. But even as much as there was more that needed to be paid. And so... That's why I got into this deal, and I'm kicking myself in the butt every day for, because you know I was looking at this thing, you know, I mean, a 12.5% annual percentage rate is not the annual yield for the bank. The annual yield for the bank, if you don't make the payment for all that time, you're talking about 63%. You know, that's ridiculous. Got to be careful about that compounded interest. And yeah, we try not to do that anymore. Yeah, Patty, I know you know Torah. I know you know it pretty well. Bankruptcy laws are, see, that's all, that's not a forgiveness, okay? That's, you got into a debt that you shouldn't have gotten into. You know, and you're taking advantage of the law, but the law is not Torah. The law of man is not Torah. You know, so you know, just because you're bucking the system a little bit by declaring bankruptcy, and by the way, bankruptcy is another thing that if you do that, you know your credit becomes like A1 again almost immediately. Because they know that you can't declare bankruptcy again for another 7 years. You know? So what that is that you're actually granting them, freedom to go ahead and loan you more money and enslave you some more, you know, and not have any recourse. Bankruptcy is not a good deal either. Sometimes we got to do it, but I'm telling you, way too many people are doing it for way too little money. You know, they get $15,000 in debt, and they can't figure out how they're going to pay it, and so they declare personal bankruptcy, which, by the way, is harder to do. They declare personal bankruptcy, and now for $15,000, they've opened themselves up to being made even greater slaves, because... You know, what got them there in the first place was their overspending, overindulging. Okay? Yah says that he'll take care of our needs, and he will. And, you know, I'm as guilty of that as anyone. I really am, and I'm repenting of it all the time. Now, as to the Rothschilds being Edomian, there are a lot of online kind of stuff that you can go and find, and it's not just online stuff. I mean, we're talking about going back, Mayor Rothschild, the first one back in the 1700s, when he set up the bank, the central bank in, I believe he set up the central bank in London, Bank of London. Anyway, the Bank of England. Anyway, whatever. All those national banks are run by Rothschild or one of his ancillaries. Okay, so and it's wickedness in the extreme. And now we see the Federal Reserve that owns very very much owns the country. You know the president gets to appoint the Federal Reserve chairman, but you know so what. You could appoint me as Federal Reserve Chairman. I would be able to get as much done. And it has to have Senate approval. But the President and the Senate, those guys are run by the central banks. They're owned by the central banks. You know, it's and by the way, conspiracy is not a theory; it's a fact. And so y'all are going, this guy's a conspiracy nut. Yeah, I am. I'm not a conspiracy nut. I'm a conspiracy truther, because that's what it is. Yehovah has had a conspiracy against him since before he created. Okay? Hasatan has been in a conspiracy against Yehovah since before he created the heavens and the earth. Okay? That's if some are correct in that he was created. The angelic hosts were created before he created anything on earth or in a physical. But even if not, he's been in conspiracy against Yehovah since before the fall of Adam. You know, even if the spirits weren't created until the fourth day, you know, the same time that the lights in the heavens were created. Okay, because he created the stars also, and the stars are likened to spiritual beings, okay. That's kind of a stretch, but anyway, Hasatan has been in a conspiracy against Yehovah since before the beginning, and so why should you not consider that the conspiracy is also going on in the physical? I mean, the spirit world can contact us spirit to spirit. And we can actually think that the idea is ours when it's actually placed there by them. Okay? How do you think the Nephilim came about? The Nephilim didn't come about because a spirit cohabited with a physical being and somehow impregnated. It doesn't work. You know, that's an entirely different species. They cannot work. They cannot interact like that. Okay? Entirely different thing. Not only an entirely different species, but an entirely different realm from which they come. Okay? But they could put the ideas into guys' minds and create hybrids and trans speciation. Okay? Anyway, we're getting way off on them. Okay. Yes. The Federal Reserve the Federal Reserve is not in the UK. The UK has the Bank of England, okay? But the Bank of England is run by Meyer Rothschild's great-great-great-great-grandson, whomever it happens to be at this time. I don't know what his name is. But the Rothschilds in Europe intermarried with all other kinds of bankers, also Edomians, Edomites, and they usury people into absolute subservience. And that's why Solomon tells us in Psalm 22:7, is it 22:7? Yeah, 22:7, that's how you get yourself into slavery. It's by going into debt. I mean, that's how a Hebrew who sold himself into slavery got there. He ended up in such debt that he couldn't pay his debts, and so he sold himself for the cost of the debt to a fellow Hebrew, who then treated him like was supposed to treat him if he did it according to Torah, treated him as a hired hand and not as a servant, and paid him as he paid a hired hand, and also gave him the loan for the debt. And when he had made enough money that he was able to buy himself back, he could do so. Okay, he could buy himself out of that debt that he had to the guy. And he had to do that interest-free, no usury, because he's a Hebrew brother. Okay, that's why this is set up like this. And then at the end of 7 years, at the end of the, rather on the Sabbath year, not on the end of 7 years, but on the Sabbath year, he had to set that guy free anyway. Also, he was told in Torah, don't not give buy your brother into servitude if there's only 6 months until the Sabbath year. Okay? Go ahead and Yehovah will bless you if you do that. Okay? I mean, this all goes together. All these things about buying a Hebrew slave and setting him free in the Sabbath year or setting him free in the Jubilee, okay, that all works together. Okay, we are not to be holding people in servitude because they need some money. If they need something and you can afford to give it, then you should give it. You should just give it. That's if you can afford to do that. You don't go into debt to help somebody out of debt. That's incredibly stupid. Anyway, I'm sorry. I got way off on a tangent. And E. Mark, you have your hand up, and you can take that mic. We're going to end up disagreeing on stuff, by the way, on this E. Mark, and it's not a problem. Still love you and all that. Anyway, here's the mic.
Boy, I even forget what I said that we're disagreeing on. But I think we agree more than you think. By the way, the perpetual debt is terrible. And that's why I thought that and again, it's a different system, but the bankruptcy laws, I think originally the Constitution or the United States had a lot of Torah in it. And I thought the release from debt every 7 years possibly came from a Torah principle. But it all gets distorted, you know, in this world. Okay, that was the point way back when. You went through so much, but the perpetual debt's terrible. What they're doing now with the student loans is ridiculous. When I went to school, I could work a work-study job. I could pay my student loans. I didn't even need student loans. I actually did very well with my investments that I was able to pay for my college just through Yah blessing me because I had a little bit of extra money from a student loan I put in a stock. And it paid for both my undergraduate and graduate education. But that was 20, 30 years ago. And boy, has this environment changed. The evil has increased 10-fold, 20-fold, 100-fold with the amount of credit, the debts. I mean, just the amount they've turned up the yoke, the amount they've turned the screws down on the people. But this credit card debt, not the credit card, the student loans, and they can never be excused. They stick with the kids for life. The one thing about the guy in office now that I thought was one of the good things that they were trying to put through was this release of the student loans where they pay for 10 years based on their income and then they're gone. They're done. And that would be a blessing if he would be able to get that to go through. That and the fact that I might be able to get health care, which has its pros and cons. Maybe I'm blessed not having health care. But if I fall off a bicycle, I haven't ridden a bicycle in the last few years because one of the fears I have, I think you might be right, Mark. I think you might be right, and same thing with everything else. They said they were going to make the credit card laws better for us. Remember, they were going to try to do the same thing with the mortgages. They say one thing, and they do the opposite. Then what they did, they took the credit cards. Mine went from 12% up to 27%. I don't want to get real deep into that. I just wanted to do a broader picture of how bad these evil ones have become, and they own our country. They own all the politicians, and it's just terrible. It makes me want to pack my bags up and move to someplace way down south. I got a couple countries I'm looking at where they don't do this stuff, where it's not a country that's built upon placing a yoke on the majority of the population to feed the rich. And doing it in such a deceitful way, it makes me sick to my stomach when I think about it. Okay, I release the mic.
Yep, I agree with you, Mark. Are there other questions or comments on this Devarim chapter 23, verses 19 and 20? If there are not, I'm going to move on to 21 to 23. 21 to 25, rather, to the end of the chapter. Okay, I have a very short commentary on that. Okay, here goes. And by the way, what I'm about to say correlates to Devarim chapter 25, which we're going to look at next week, 25:4. Okay, when you enter a neighbor's field, either to help with the harvest or to just pass through it, you are allowed to eat as you go, but you are not allowed to harvest to carry it away. That's the point of those two verses. To harvest and carry away is to steal from your brother, essentially the same as the usurer steals from the borrower. Remember the Talmudim picking corn and eating it on the Shabbat in Matthew chapter 12 and verse 1, and the Pharisees getting all huffy about it? There was no Torah command against picking enough food to eat, only against harvesting for profit on the Shabbat, so the Prushim were being legalists, holding their traditions to be as legally binding as Torah. That was the problem there. And that's all I've got on those two verses. Sorry, I think I missed 23 to 20. Oh, I'm sorry, I missed 21 to 23. When we make a vow to Yehovah, we are stupid in the extreme if we fail to honor it. Not only is it sin to us, but he'll see to it that the vow is paid to the uttermost farthing. If a mere man will require a vow of you, what makes you think Yehovah will not? In Matthew chapter 5, verses 23 to 26, it is written, Therefore, if thou bring thy gift to the altar, and there rememberest that thy brother hath aught against thee, leave there thy gift before the altar, and go thy way. First, be reconciled to thy brother, and then come and offer thy gift. Agree with thine adversary quickly, whilst thou art in the way with him, lest at any time the adversary deliver thee to the judge, and the judge deliver thee to the officer, and thou be cast into prison. Verily I say unto you, thou shalt by no means come out thence till thou hast paid the uttermost farthing. Before you make a vow, you had no obligation, and there was not even a chance you could sin. Essentially, if you say you're going to do something, do it. Be known as a man or woman of your word, one who can be trusted. I very seldom make a vow to anybody. Unless I know for certain that I'm going to be able to do it, I will not make a vow. I will not promise anything. And that's because of this verse, and it's this thing in Matthew chapter 12. I mean, Matthew chapter 5. It's very important to understand this. If you make a vow, you are honor-bound, at least honor-bound, to perform it. And if you make a vow and you don't perform it, Yehovah is going to make sure that you end up performing it, or you're going to run into some major problems until you do. Okay, so that's what I got on 21 to 25. And if there are any questions or comments, I'll be happy to see them. I'm sorry, we're in Devarim chapter 23 right now, and we're going to be going to 24 in a minute. 24. Verses 1 to 4, and then somewhat following after that. Questions or comments, anybody? Yeah, you're right, Dumrod. Many people don't value their word anymore. They'll say, yeah, I'll do that, and then when they don't do it, sorry, you shouldn't have trusted me, something like that. And unfortunately, people are becoming less and less trustworthy as time goes on. It began, I think, when we started questioning Yehovah and his word, when we started questioning whether or not he actually created, okay, and, you know, came into that evolution kind of crap back in the 1850s. That's what really started it, was when we made Elohim into just another creature, and, that he didn't have any more to do with us than that. And then, since he was just another creature, he wasn't Elohim, then his word was questionable, and so we could question his word. And then when we could question his word, we could say, well, you know, what's this stuff about sodomy? You know, what's this stuff about a man lying with a man or a woman lying with a woman or with a dog, with an animal or whatever? I mean, that's all so subjective, you know, and that's how we started to think about it. I'm talking about the human race. It's only those of us who are still looking to Yehovah as the truth and reading his word and accepting it for what it says that are, and we are so much outcasts anymore. Man, just wait until the government gets to be absolutely a tyranny. I mean, right now it's tyrannical enough, but you haven't seen nothing yet, folks. And it's gonna come that they're gonna persecute us big time. I mean, big time. Really bad. Anyway, are there questions or comments out there on Devarim chapter 23 and verses 19 to 25? Yes, even people who claim to be believers in Yehovah. You're right, Dumrod. You're absolutely correct. Anyway. Here's the deal. When I entered into credit card debt, I entered into a vow. Okay? And Yehovah is going to see to it that I pay that. One way or another. Okay? I'm going to get to live in basic servitude until I get that stuff paid off. And the longer I let it go, the worse the debt gets. Now, I told you about what happens if you, you know, at a 12.5% annual interest rate. If you go into those 12 months same as cash and you don't make a payment for those first 12 months, when you make that first payment in the 13th month, you're going to owe $1,600 on a $1,000 note. A 63% interest rate over that time because they compound it monthly, not yearly. You're not paying a simple 12.5% rate. You know, I could afford to allow them to, you know, to charge me $125 on that $1,000 note. Okay, I could afford to let that go. That's the first payment. That's not a big deal. But when you compound that thing monthly, it ends up being 63.5%. Wow, that hurts. And then you pay interest on the interest. That's what really hurts, because you're paying the interest on the interest. It's nuts. It's absolutely nuts. It's wickedness in the extreme. And that's one of the things that the central banks do all the time. That's what they do when they loan the cash that they print to the Treasury. The Federal Reserve prints the cash, right? The Treasury borrows it from them, and they pay an interest rate, whatever it is. It doesn't even matter what it is. It could be the prime rate. It could be 0% at this point, or maybe 1%, whatever. Whatever it is, they're paying interest on money that the Fed just printed. And they loan it to the government at face value. Okay, so if they print $10 million, okay, which is like 100 sheets of $100 bills, okay, $10 million, right? They loan that for $10 million, but it costs them a grand total of $270 to print. Okay, so, man, you want to talk about, if you want to talk about a business you ought to be in, man, be a central banker. There's some profit. Anyway, getting off on the tangent again, because that's one of my absolute pet peeves about what we have to deal with every day. Okay. If there are no questions and comments, oh, Barak Yahoo, you have your hand up. You got in just under the gun. I was about to move on. Okay, here we go. Take the mic.
Well, that's what we do in this room. We're actually trying to see what Yah says. Where religion before Constantine. That's the whole thing with the Pharisees. It was what they wanted to say, and what they said was declared as legally binding over even over what Yah says by the hand of Moses. And then with Constantinianism, there we go again. Same noise. It's whatever the Pope says over the Word of God. So it's the religion of man. Then we, now, recently, we have just taken the next logical step. Instead of what does the Pope say or what does the pastor say, it's what do I think? Your mic.
All right. Thank you, Barak Yahoo. I appreciate that. And I'm looking in the text right here. I see Mark 222B. I'm sorry, 222B. It says, there are many instances when we say we will do something based upon someone else doing something, and then they do not do it as they have said. And Mark 222 finds that Jehovah has him keep to what he said regardless. And you know what? You're exactly right. You've made a vow. It doesn't matter that somebody else didn't keep their end of it. You made a vow, and he will hold you to it. And that's what we're talking about in Deuteronomy chapter 23. The end of the chapter talks about vows. You've got to be very careful about making vows, promising to do anything. When you go into a court and they ask, do you swear to tell the truth or affirm to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God, and they don't even do that anymore. They leave off the so help you God thing. You're making a vow. And you can tell the truth as far as you know it, and it end up not being true. Okay? So, you know, I mean, they're asking you for an eyewitness kind of thing, that's one thing. But if they're asking you to testify to something that you really don't know, you got to tell them, nah, I don't know. I can't tell you that. You know, I can surmise, but that's all I can do. You know, you can't go in there and make a vow to them. You can say, I will tell the truth. I will affirm to that. I will tell the truth. But it's the truth as I know it, not as you may have found out. Okay? Correct. We're not to swear on anything. We can't make it do anything that we want it to do. We can't make the truth happen. All we can do is testify to what we know in ourselves, and not what someone wants us to get out. Anyway, that's another thing. Devarim chapter 24. If there aren't any more questions, I'm moving towards 24, and I will look to see if there's a hand up when I get there, or if there's another text message. What do we got here? No hands. Nothing new in the text. Okay, moving on. Chapter 24. Not 4. 24. Okay, here we go. And we're looking up to verse 19. I think that's the end of the chapter. When a man hath taken a wife and married her, and it come to pass that she find no favor in his eyes, because he hath found some uncleanness in her, then let him write her a bill of divorcement, and give it in her hand, and send her out of his house. And when she is departed out of his house, she may go to be another man's wife. And if the latter husband hate her, and write her a bill of divorcement, and giveth it in her hand, and sendeth her out of his house, or if the latter husband die, which took her to be his wife, her former husband, which sent her away, may not take her again to be his wife, after that she is defiled. For that is abomination before Jehovah, and thou shalt not cause the land to sin, which Jehovah Elohecha giveth thee for an inheritance. I'm going to stop there because we're going to comment on that, and we'll read 5 and following after. Okay, the main point of these verses is to prohibit the original husband to remarry the divorced wife after she has married another man. What if she commits adultery before she is divorced? Torah commands that she should be stoned along with her co-sinner. What if the husband merely suspects her of adultery? The Midbar 5 says that there we see the law of jealousy, in which the woman drinks the bitter water. Yeshua took the curse of the adulterous woman from Bamidbar 5 and died her death so that he could remarry the defiled woman upon his resurrection. He divorced her in Jeremiah chapter 3 and verse 8, drank our bitter water, vinegar sans the gall, died our death according to Torah in Bamidbar 5, and then rose a totally new man. Old things passed away. Behold, all things are become new in 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 17. To marry us, as in this passage and Romans chapter 7 and verses 1 through 4. Eddie Chumney has a wonderful teaching on this juxtaposition of Deuteronomy 24, 1 to 4, and Romans 7, 1 to 4 in his Pesach PowerPoints. And it is a wonderful teaching. You might be able to see that on Eddie's website, which is hebrews.org. In Revelation chapter 20, we see the New Jerusalem coming down out of heaven, adorned as a bride for her husband. This is the bride of Messiah, arrayed in fine linen, white and clean, signifying her virginity, even as an American woman dresses for her wedding, though fewer and fewer are genuinely able to do so now. Anyway, but that was not our condition only a short time before. Before the resurrection, we were anything but virgins, spiritually, even if a few of us may be physically. So as Eddie has told us, we were an adulterous wife to whom Yehovah Yeshua had given a certificate of divorce. We went off and defiled ourselves with another Elohim of our own making, permanently sealing our divorce according to Devarim chapter 24. But Yehovah put on human flesh of Yeshua so that he could live a perfectly righteous life, fulfilling Torah in every aspect applicable to him, so that he could then vicariously suffer for us the punishment that we deserved, as seen in Bamidbar chapter 5. According to Devarim chapter 24, verses 1 to 4, the first husband could not again marry his defiled wife, and he was under this restriction until he died. But fortunately for us, and perfectly within the plan of Yehovah, he didn't stay dead. He rose after 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth as a completely new man. Now, look at 2 Peter chapter 9, chapter 3, verses 9 through 12, where it is written, Yehovah is not slack concerning his promise, as some men count slackness, but is long-suffering to usward, not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. But the day of Yehovah will come as a thief in the night, in the which the heavens shall pass away with a great noise, and the elements shall melt with a fervent heat. The earth also and the works that are therein shall be burned up. Seeing then that all these things shall be dissolved, what manner of persons ought ye to be in all holy conversation and reverence, looking for and hasting unto the coming of the day of Yehovah, wherein the heavens being on fire shall be dissolved, and the elements shall melt with a fervent heat. Then in Revelation chapter 20, in verses 11 and 21 in verse 1, the one verse ends chapter 20, and the next verse starts chapter 21, it is written, And I saw a great white throne, and him that sat on it, from whose face the earth and the heaven fled away, and there was found no place for them. And I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth were passed away, and there was no more sea. When Yeshua arose, his Talmudim, the people he'd lived intimately among for 3.5 years, did not recognize him in his resurrected body until he chose to reveal himself to them, first to Mary, then the Emmaus Road guys, then to Shimon Kepha. The new heaven and earth is not identical to the old, but merely similar, no more sea, etc. Now, if the creation was so affected by the fall of Adam that it cannot be made clean enough for Yehovah to permanently dwell there, and it has to be made entirely new, must not the same be true of our physical bodies? In a similar way, I think that Yeshua is a completely new man so that he can marry his estranged wife. And she, or rather we, will have entirely new bodies with no admixture of the old, similar in appearance, but not identical. This is in line with 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 17, wherein it is written, Therefore, if any man be in Messiah, he is a new creature. Old things are passed away. Behold, all things are become new. How many things were made new? We do not constantly see this in our lives, since we deal with the old nature, or rather the evil inclination. But in the resurrection, in the new heaven and earth, there will be no evil inclination, or sin nature, if you will, to deal with. For now, we get to taste the glory of Yeshua that he will give us in our new resurrected beings. Now we partake by our position in Mashiach, but then we will know the fullness of our salvation. We will truly be virgins in our new bodies, made righteous by the blood of Messiah, graciously provided with a perfect and sinless body, suited for life in a perfect and unfallen creation. And that's what I've got on the first four verses of Devarim chapter 24. If there are questions or comments, I'll be happy to give you the mic. Just raise your hand. Okay. Yes, Watcher, that's a very good comment. He did divorce us, but then he died and he was raised a brand new man. There'd never been anything like him before. Okay? So the Yehovah that lived within the body of Yeshua experienced the death, experienced the resurrection, caused the resurrection to happen. And he raised Yeshua a new man so that he could marry that wife that he had given a certificate of divorce to, you know, way back when. Okay. We have moments, not of no Yetzer Hara, but of overcoming the Yetzer Hara. Okay? And that's what an overcomer does. And we do that as we become more and more like Messiah, we do that more and more. Yes. Good. Emark, you have a comment. Take the mic.
Oh, I'll take it, but I'll give it back. No, it's actually good. You mentioned that Eddie, I don't know if that originally came from Eddie, but I'd heard that also, that basically Mashiach came, and by besides other things that he was able to accomplish through his death, and setting a shining example of Torah in his walk, in his life, and being Torah in the flesh, so to speak, the Word made flesh. But his death then allows us as the body to remarry, because once the husband dies, the wife's available to remarry. And then we just remarry, I guess, the new incarnation of Yeshua when he returns again. That's a little bit odd for us in this earthly plane. But I believe that actually helped me a lot in my understanding and learning. If I got that right, then correct me if I didn't capture that the way you described it. I'm curious, was Eddie the first one that you heard that from, or did he bring that from somebody else? And because possibly then the person I heard it from read it from Eddie, or, you know, maybe just Yah's giving it to many. But it's really a cool understanding. I'll release the mic. I'll give it back to you, Mark. Thanks for letting me borrow it.
Yes, Eddie is the first one I heard that from. He has it so well laid out in the PowerPoint that I saw, and he stopped along the way and explained a little bit more as he was going. It's a very, very good teaching, and it's really only about 14 or 15 PowerPoint slides. In the middle of one of the Pesach PowerPoints. I can't remember even which one it is right off. But it was during one of the Pesach PowerPoints, of which he's got four. So anyway, he goes through how he suffered the death of the unfaithful bride. He goes through 24, 1 through 4, and then Romans 7, and draws the parallels, and it's really very good stuff. And he does it quickly, you know, and succinctly. And it's really well done. Much better than I do. Anyway, Mark 222B, you have your hand up and you may take the mic.
Thank you. My question was for Watcher. When you asked a while ago Watcher a question, you said you addressed the question to Mark, and I didn't know if there was another Mark in the room or if you were talking to me. But the answer to the question that you asked in my mind is that in Mark chapter 9, when the Lord is speaking on divorce, Mark chapter 10, verse 9, he says, "What therefore God hath joined together, let not man put asunder." So my view on that is that when we are born again and become the bride of Christ, that he would not put us away. That's my view on that, based on that passage. But my other question is there another Mark in the room? Maybe he was not addressing me. Maybe it was not for me to answer. Is someone else in the room named Mark?
Yeah, there's E-Mark is in the room. And he's the guy that's been on the mic before today. That's E-Mark. So, and that's E-Mark with a C, and you're Mark with a K, and I'm Mark with a K. So we got at least three people in the room today who are Marks. Okay. Yeah. Okay, so other questions or comments? Yeah, E-Mark, that is right around when you met us guys. We probably met about, I met you at Sukkot. I think it was in 2005. And, Eddie gave this teaching, I'm pretty sure, just before Pesach in 2005. So, at least that's the first time I ever saw it. It may be something that he's had for 10 years before that. Jeremiah chapter 3 and verse 8 talks about Yehovah divorcing Ephraim and giving her a bill of divorce and sending her away. And then he also says, and Yehuda, her adulterous sister, did even worse than she did. But Yehovah didn't give Yehuda a bill of divorce. But he did to Ephraim, the 10 northern tribes, and sent them off. He finally sent them off, even Yehuda off to Babylon, but he never gave her a certificate of divorce. Okay. Okay, you're Mark B. Good deal. E-Mark, you have your hand up. You can take the mic.
Hey, check this out. You didn't see me the last 2 weeks. And here's why. I met Rico, believe it or not. I had a dentist appointment that came a week early. And my dentist, who's really cool, his name's Tim Carr. I think I talked to you about him. He's the one who lost his son on the Tabernacles a few years back. He invited me. I usually go up and have my tooth. It takes me four or five hours to get to my dentist, but I get to hang out. We usually come before Sabbath. Spent Sabbath with him, and they tried to do this before. It's the first time I was successful. They had a conference in Penn State, and Rico, the local congregation, had Rico there. He's my brother. I mean, he literally is. And David gets very interested what a small world it is. But Rico was speaking at this conference, and I didn't even know it. And it was doctor's orders. He had me come up. I got the coolest dentist, and he took me with their family, 12 kids. They lost one, but they got another little baby. What a wonderful, that's why I missed the last 2 weeks, by the way. I just wanted to share that, what a blessing that was. And when I met Rico, because I had studied with him in Pow-Talk, I used to open up rooms way back when. And by the way, I had that understanding before I came, and I think it probably might have come from Eddie, but it was with the guy that I was studying with, Carol, and I told you about that story way back. We're not going to go down there. But Rico was really cool. He's going to teach me how to do the Aaronic blessing. Maybe not as good as you do it, Mark, but eventually I want to learn to do it sort of with the tonality. I don't know if you've heard him do it. I think Monty Judah's son uses his style of singing, but it was that was such a wonderful and it's such a nice little growth period I've been going through recently to get to meet him as well as a lot of brethren. Here's why I'm just finish up with this one point. We went to the conference. As soon as we walked in, my friend Tim, who's my dentist, says, "Hey, Mark, this is your place. This is your place. Listen, Mark's on the right." People there were names, and there was about four Marks with a C and a lot more Marks. And then there was a bunch of Davids, but not our friend David who does the song He's Faithful. He would have fit right in, though. And what a blessing. In fact, it was very near where his wife lives in that area of the woods. What a blessed week and couple weeks I've had. And I'll share with you some other things that Yaz opened up to me that I wanted to get your direction on. If you can catch up with me, maybe even early during the week. But he's got me now working with the homeless shelter in the area here. I wanted to get your feedback on maybe some things I could do. Let me release the mic, though, but I wanted to share that with you.
We missed you, E-Mark. We did. Like a toothache, we missed you. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, and like I put in the text there, if I had a choice between Rico and me, I would choose Rico every time. So I'm very serious about that. If I had known that Rico was going to be in Pittsburgh, I might have been there too. Or wherever that was. Anyway, other questions or comments on Devarim chapter 24, verses 1 to 4? It's time for Ephraim to go home. Ephraim Judah lives in Oklahoma. He is home. Anyway, here we go. I'm going to move on to to the end of the chapter. Starting in verse 5. Where is it? There it is. When a man hath taken a new wife, he shall not go out to war, neither shall he be charged with any business, but he shall be free at home 1 year, and shall cheer up his wife which he hath taken. No man shall take the nether or the upper millstone to pledge, for he taketh a man's life to pledge. If a man be found stealing any of his children, or brethren of his, of the, I'm sorry, let me stop. If a man be found stealing any of his brethren of the children of Israel, and maketh merchandise of him, or selleth him, then that thief shall die, and thou shalt put evil away from among you. Take heed in the plague of leprosy, that thou observe diligently to do according to all that the priests, the Levites, shall teach you. As I command them, so ye shall observe to do. Remember that Jehovah Elohecha did unto Miriam by the way, after that ye were come out of Egypt. When thou dost lend thy brother anything, thou shalt not go into his house to fetch his pledge. Thou shalt stand abroad, and the man to whom thou dost lend shall bring out the pledge abroad unto thee. And if the man be poor, thou shalt not sleep with his pledge. If in any case thou shalt deliver him the pledge again, when the sun goeth down, that he may sleep in his own raiment and bless thee. And it shall be righteousness unto thee before Jehovah Elohecha. Thou shalt not oppress an hired servant that is poor and needy, whether he be of thy brethren or of thy strangers that are in the land within thy gates. At his day thou shalt give him his hire, neither shall the sun go down upon it. For he is poor and setteth his heart upon it, lest he cry against thee unto Jehovah and it be sin unto thee. The fathers shall not be put to death for the children, neither shall the children be put to death for the fathers. Every man shall be put to death for his own sin. Thou shalt not pervert the judgment of the stranger, nor of the fatherless, nor take a widow's raiment to pledge. But thou shalt remember that thou wast a bondman in Egypt, and Jehovah Elohecha redeemed thee thence. Therefore I command thee to do this thing. When thou cuttest down thine harvest in thy field, and hast forgotten a sheaf in the field, thou shalt not go again to fetch it. It shall be for the stranger, for the fatherless, and for the widow, that Yehovah, thy Elohim, may bless thee in all the work of thine hands. And I believe I was supposed to stop at verse 18. And that's where I'm going to stop now. Okay. Here's my brief commentary on those verses. In verse 5, we see that a man was not to work for 1 year after his marriage to cheer up his new bride. I think this has to do with staying around to start a family, with the assumption being that she would bear his first child in that time. Nothing would bring more joy or more cheer than a new baby. In verses 6 and 7, one was not to take anything as collateral that would deprive a man of his ability to provide for himself and his family. Trading in Israelite souls was forbidden. Verboten, I put in here. The slave was to be stoned to remove such sin from the gates. Remember last week's midrash, where we were to have a paddle in the non-business end of our swords so that we could keep the camp clean of our waste products? Here is some human waste that was to be removed from Yehovah's sight. Remember that if we allow that which defiles in our camp, Yehovah cannot walk among us, and we chance losing the battle or the war. In verses 8 and 9, we're dealing with the same thing. We are to guard against leprosy, which typifies sin throughout Scripture. It needs to be dealt with immediately. Miriam had rebelled versus Moshe, and as punishment, she was made totally leprous immediately. As an example, she was also forgiven and cleansed of her leprosy immediately upon her repentance, but still had to fulfill the law of the leper and live outside the camp for 7 days. The sin could not be in the camp, or Yehovah could not walk there among us. Verse 10 to 13 are about taking a pledge. You are not to enter the debtor's house to take his pledge. I'm sorry, you are not to enter the... if you're loaning money, then you are the debtor. And you're not to enter into the man's house to take his pledge, but let him bring it to you. And it says that you will go abroad to get it. So you're standing outside of his property, and he is bringing the thing to you outside of his property as well. Okay? You're not going into his property. Yehovah absolutely respects property rights. He expects both parties to respect each other's rights as he does ours. We are not to keep a brother's pledge overnight. This, I think, I'm not certain, but I think, and this is an italicized I think, which means it's an educated guess, and I could be wrong, but I seriously doubt it. This, I think, is the basis for the Fourth Amendment warrant to search a man's premises for evidence of a crime. Verse 14 and 15 tell us to pay the wages due and pay them on time. To not do so is sin to us. In Israel, that meant that you paid your day laborers at the end of the day, as Yeshua said in the parable that he spoke. Said, so when even was come, the Lord of the vineyard saith unto his servant, call the laborers and give them their hire, beginning from the last unto the first. And when they came that were hired about the 11th hour, they received every man a penny. This is where the nobleman goes out and he hires day laborers to work in his vineyard. Okay? And he hires some at the beginning of the day, and he enters into the contract and he says, I'll pay you a penny for a day's labor. They went and they worked and then he went out on the third hour and he found more guys standing around. He said, hey, you want work? Go over to my vineyard. I'll pay you what's right. And then he goes out on the sixth hour and again on the ninth hour and again on the 11th hour. And he went to the guys that he hired at the 11th hour, and they picked for maybe an hour, and he paid them a penny. And then he went to the next people and he gave them a penny. And when he got to the people that he hired the first part of the day and he gave them a penny, they got all ticked. Hey, what are you doing paying us a penny? You paid that guy a penny. He's only worked an hour. We worked all day. You're still paying us a penny. What's that all about? We should be getting more money. And the guy says, did I not enter into a contract with you? And I told you I'd pay you a penny. It's none of your business what I paid the other guy. None of your business what I paid them. You just have to worry about the contract that we worked out. Okay? That's another thing that comes directly from Torah, by the way. No impairment of contracts. Okay? And that's constitutional as well in the United States. There is to be no impairment of contracts. The government cannot impair any contract that you enter into. Okay. Verse 16 requires that we punish only those worthy of punishment, not those associated with them or related to them. The guilty bears responsibility for his own crimes. Verse 17 tells us to be righteous judges in all matters and not to respect persons in judgment. Then in verse 18, he reminds us why we are to deal equitably with all men, because we were oppressed, cheated, robbed, bullied, and etc. while we were in Egypt. We didn't like it, and so we should treat others as we wished and wish to be treated. This is the golden rule, Torah style. And that's what I have for the Torah portion for today. Are there any questions or comments? Yes. Very good, Mark 22, or Mark B. That's what you said. You want to be Mark B. Okay, Mark 2:22. You're absolutely right. The onset of these diseases is pretty much pronounced. We can know them, and we can work on them. You know, leprosy can be taken care of in a hyperbaric chamber. Do you know that? If you go, the pressure and the oxygen just oxygenates your whole body so well. And it's relaxing and all that. I mean, hyperbaric chambers are good things, and they can take care of a lot of ailments that you have. They can. Leprosy, by the way, in the scripture was not what we call leprosy today. Leprosy in the scripture was actually probably a very bad case of psoriasis. If you've ever seen a patch of psoriasis on a person's skin, it's all white and flaky, okay? It's red underneath, and that's basically what it describes in I think it's in Leviticus, where it talks about leprosy. Sunny Patty in Kansas, you have your hand up, and you may take the mic.
Mic check. Okay, thank you. This past week, this totally amazes me, because when you follow the Torah to the best you can, and that's what I try to do, I find that so many things go much easier for me. This past week, I came down with that flu, that 7-day flu, which I still have a little bit of it. But what amazed me is, as you get older, these flus can be very deadly. And I noticed on my Facebook page, a 14-year-old girl came down with that flu, and she died. And yet, I came down with the same thing, and I'm still alive. It did not hit me as hard as I thought it would, even though I stayed in bed for days, just drinking water and green tea and, doing what I need to do. But, you know, when you follow the Torah, and he says that none of these diseases I will put upon you, even though I came down with the flu, it did not hit me as to where I had to end up in the ER or at a doctor's office. I kind of took care of it myself with the help of the Lord. So I just wanted to give that testimony that it really pays to follow God's laws and obey Him. And I just wanted to share that. I'll release the mic now.
Thank you, Patty. By the way, you don't sound like you're a native Kansan. You sound more like you're a native New Englander. Is that true? Just give me a one or something like that. You are, okay. All right. I was just curious, you know. It is pretty amazing. If you do things the way that Torah says to do them, they generally do go a lot easier. It's when we start doing things our own way that we start seeing problems. Born in Boston, Mass. Boston, Mass. Okay. I can hear just a little bit of a New England accent. Not a lot, but some. And, you know, it's kind of like Henry Kissinger, you know, with his German accent. His is really heavy because he wants it to be. His brother came over at the same time he did, and he doesn't have any accent at all. And Dumrod, you're correct. It's not just oregano. There are so many spices that we use in our cooking that are also incredibly, incredibly good blood cleansers and things like that, that can just wipe out antibiotics and antivirals. That it just wipes out sickness in us, you know, in and of itself. I mean, like oregano, like garlic, like elderberry, just stuff that can just kill stuff like that in its tracks. I have a bottle of elderberry extract upstairs here, and when I start feeling a cold coming on, I drop 30 or 40 drops of elderberry extract in a drink and drink it down, and I'm here to tell you, it kills it. It kills a cold like that. Maybe you heard that finger snap. It kills a cold like on the spot. And colloidal silver, you got a bacterial infection, colloidal silver will kill it. I mean, it will kill it. I've got a salve upstairs. Nature's Sunshine makes a thing called Silver Shield, and it's an ointment kind of thing. It's a skin conditioner kind of stuff, but it's impregnated with colloidal silver. And what they're doing over in Afghanistan, and what they were doing in Iraq, you know, with all the fighting that's going on over there, the Navy, the medics, and the Navy corpsmen that go out with the Marines have just tubes and tubes of this stuff in their packs. And if somebody gets wounded in battle, they'll take a tube of this stuff, and the tube has got to be 5 or 6 ounces of hand cream packed with colloidal silver. And they'll just squeeze that stuff into a wound, and then they'll bandage it and send the guy off to the trauma hospital. And they have not lost one guy, not one person has lost his life or a limb due to an infection in that wound that was treated with the silver shield. Not one. I mean, it's incredible stuff, colloidal silver. It just kills bacteria. So, you know, gangrene, that kind of stuff, that's a bacterial thing, you know. And by the way, hyperbaric chamber will take care of gangrene too. There's no need to go through all the amputations and stuff. You know, unless there's major trauma done to a limb, there isn't any need to do that kind of thing. You should be able to take care of it with proper treatment, and that's just how that is. Most things will be taken care of. You'll kill most bacteria inside your body by with a hyperbaric chamber, because oxygen will kill bacteria, anaerobic bacteria. It'll kill it. So, and that's most of the bacteria that lives inside you. What's cool about colloidal silver, though, is that it doesn't kill gut bacteria. You know, it's really cool stuff. It's Jehovah's antibiotic. It will kill bacteria as soon as it gets near it. So, anyway, that's a tangent that we got off on too. You know what? That's right, Sandy. They'll chew that. They'll eat that stuff away and take the gangrene right out of there. They'll actually eat the stuff. And Which is, you know, the idea of putting maggots on somebody's wound is pretty incredible, but it does work. Don't eat the maggots. That's right, Mark. Very good. E-Mark, you have your hand up. You can take the mic. Hey, listen, I gotta go take a real quick break. I'll be back in about a minute. So you go ahead and take the mic, Mark.
So he's not going to be able to disagree with me. No, I actually, if you eat the colloidal silver, I've heard of people turning blue. Supposedly there's limits on that. But topically, I got to get the name of that product because that would be good. I didn't realize that's really nice. What I was, you guys remember the old flu? You remember when you used to get the flu and you'd be sick for a few days and then you'd get well again and now they give you shots? I haven't taken a flu shot in a long time. And I'll tell you what, I haven't got the flu in a long time, but I haven't been interacting with people a whole lot in the past couple of years because of some injuries I've been dealing with. So, well, I don't know. That's not good. Interacting with people is good. I used to teach skiing. So when I would do that, I'd be in touch with kids a lot with the runny noses and stuff, but I don't like the flu shots. I wonder, and I've heard that they're biologically designing these flus and these other diseases, so that's why they're probably getting, who knows? I don't even want to go down that road that deeply. But that ironically, I got elderberry jam when I was on my trip. They have like an Amish or a Mennonite store up where my friends are. And they get stuff that's closeouts and stuff, and it's so cheap. I buy tons of food up there. But the elderberry jam, which I purposely picked elderberry because they had other really good preserves, but the elderberry I wanted, because I don't know where elderberries are around here yet. I need to go and learn my herbs a little bit better. But echinacea and golden seal is what I typically get. I get a combination. We have Giant Eagle around here, and they have their brand echinacea golden seal, or just echinacea. And if I feel myself getting cold, getting something coming on, take that cayenne pepper. I love pepper, all kinds of hot peppers. That helps. I think that oxygenates your blood, but it also releases the endorphins. But all the herbs of the field, that's what they're for, our nutrition and for healing, right? Goes back to Genesis, I believe, right at the beginning they talked about that. You know, Mark went on so much, there was a couple other comments. I'm going to release it to... There was one other comment I wanted to make, and I'll release it to Mark B. There's Mark C. Mark P, actually, it would be. Anyways, let me release the mic, and maybe I'll come back. But the Mark, with Mark back, if you can share with me, try to catch up with me or email me. I tried to get through to you through your admin here. I wanted to try to get some email going back and forth between us because I've got to deal with trying to teach these people that I've been studying with to wear tzitzit tassels because they've got bad translations of the newer writings and they're still a little bit stuck in their Christianity perspective, but they're coming along. I mean, they did Sabbath. They got that years and years and years ago. They're just for some reason not wearing tassels. We were talking about the food laws this week in their Bible study, and it's ironic. I almost said, I just have to be very gentle. I almost said, hey, wait, so you're arguing that we still need to keep the food laws. We need to keep those commandments. Why aren't you wearing tassels? And one of the guys wears a real nice garment, like similar to what Eddie wears, but a little bit cooler looking. And he's got tassels, and I asked him last week, Do you have a blue thread wrapped around this? And I know he used to wear tzitzit, and sometimes he wears a prayer shawl. That's the one guy who's closer to our understanding. By the way, he used to listen to Eddie and you guys years ago, and they still do, but they do a little study. They conflict a little bit. I do the afternoon with them. They do a morning thing there that I'd rather be here with you, believe it or not. But I wanted to get your help in trying to gently bring them along. I'm thinking it's not your help I need. It's Yahweh's help. It's Yahweh. Jehovah, Yod Heh Vav Heh. It's a big guy upstairs. I got to look to him, and he's been doing it. He's been giving me just basically when they're teaching, I ask questions. And my questions, I think, are coming from Yah because I pray before every time we go there. And I think they're going to be wearing tassels pretty soon. But that's not the most important thing. They've been such a blessing to me. Let me release the mic. And please, Mark, if you can, we can try to get some type of communication between now and maybe next Sabbath, that would be a blessing. And then I also just started to minister at a homeless shelter, and I could use you. I know you've worked with the prisons before, I think. And I could really use your okay, let me release the mic. But I don't know if you caught the stuff I was talking about with the healing stuff, though. I'm sure you already know all that stuff. Okay, mic's free.
Thank you, Mark, for filling in for me while I was away on a bio break. I'm looking at some of the comments in the thing here. Never had a flu shot, Mashika. The only time I've ever gotten the flu in the last 30 years was when I got a flu shot. I got the flu twice while I was in the Navy. I vowed never to, because they made me take the flu shot. The third time I told them, I'm not taking the flu shot. You can go ahead and give me a page 13 entry, whatever you got to do in my service record. I will not take that shot. The only time I've ever gotten sick in the last, 20 years was when I took that shot. I'm not doing it anymore. And I said, oh, okay, don't worry about it. That was that. had to be very strident with them, but they said, well, if you don't want it, you don't have to take it. Okay, see ya. Amazing. They give you an order to go take the flu shot, and then they countermand the order because you tell them, I won't do it. I'm not going to get sick because you want to give me that thing. Anyway, that's what I say about the flu shot all the time. Mark 222B. Can you give me some kind of idea why you call yourself that? I'm just curious. I see the 222 and I immediately think of the TV show from the 70s, Room 222. Anyway, I'll give you the mic.
Sure, I'd be glad to let you know why. For one thing, it's one of my favorite Bible verses is Mark chapter 2, verse 22, in that area. Actually, the whole thing in context, but one of my favorite Bible verses in one. But then other than that, 2 being my favorite number, and then my name is Mark, and my last name starts with a B. And so, put it all together, it seemed like a logical, very logical nickname or internet nick or whatever. My question was, does anyone know of anything through herbs, spices, or whatever else, natural treatments for an overactive thyroid? Periodically suffer from something that's similar to eczema. It's called Graves' dermopathy. It's caused by the thyroid. The only difference that you'd notice from eczema is that this exudes toxins from the legs, which is not where toxins are supposed to be eliminated, through the pores of the skin of the legs. And I'm talking about a lot. And the only thing I have for treatment so far is a hydrotherapy treatment, whereby I sit in hot water for about 2 hours with Epsom salts. And, I don't use any aspartame. Although I did notice that it started, the onset of it was when I was trying to diet using aspartame, and I may have aggravated it. At any rate, the only thing that seems to work for the symptoms in the legs is the hot baths with Epsom salts. But I was wondering if there, instead of treating just the symptoms, if there was a way to assist the thyroid so that it's not overactive. And I don't know if anybody knows of a way to do that or not. Anyway, if someone knows of a way to do that, please let me know. I'd love to know if there's a natural way to do that.
Okay, well, it's out there. You've got 17 people here that can do some advice on that. I don't know, or I would tell you. There is a My wife showed me a thing about a diet yesterday. It's kind of a restrictive diet. But what the deal is that this woman had a child who had been diagnosed with autism, and she put her on a specific diet. I can't remember what it is right offhand right now, but the diet absolutely cured the kid of autism. Okay? Autism is gone. Still has some learning disabilities, but not anything like what she had with the autism. Yeah, diet is incredibly important. And if we were to just do what Yehovah tells us to do and eat what he tells us to eat, you'd be amazed. By the way, this little girl had celiac as a part of the autism. Okay, I mean she was very sensitive to wheat. And when the diet was over, when the autism was gone, her gut was completely healed, the problem was that her gut had problems, and it's what caused all of it. And it didn't say whether or not the kid had childhood immunizations, but that's something that literally causes autism. So, but anyway, that may have to do with the problems that the kid had in her gut. If you can address that, fixing your digestive system from stomach to colon, that's a large contributor to problems, all different kinds of problems in human beings. There was a guy named a doctor named Gerson back in the 20s who developed an anti-cancer treatment that was basically going to natural foods and doing a regular green coffee enema. I think it was he did that daily. And what the green coffee enema did was it flushed his liver, flushed the bile out of his liver, and it cleansed that thing. And once he got the liver cleansed, then the filtration system was working again. And once they got that done, he did that daily for a certain amount of time, and once the liver was clean, he was able to just do a maintenance kind of deal, and he actually was finding cancer being cured by doing things like that. So, I mean, most of the dread diseases that we have today are because we've gotten away from eating what Yehovah gave us to eat, you know. So that's a big deal. Look at the food laws. Follow them. It says that we're supposed to eat all of the herbs bearing herbs, the green herbs and the fruit bearing seeds. Okay, you got to eat the seeds with the fruit. There are so many vitamins and nutrients in the seeds that we don't eat. And by the way, they have to be non-GMO. Okay, because the GMO stuff isn't alive. It isn't alive. It's at least not as far as our bodies are concerned. There's nothing there that's alive. The reason that they GMO the things is so that they'll have a longer shelf life. The reason they pasteurize things is because they have a longer shelf life. And it's all done so that the corporations that own the government can maximize their profits. And it doesn't matter that it's not any good for you, that there's nothing. If bacteria won't live in milk that's been ultra-pasteurized, what makes you think that that milk is going to sustain your life? Right? I mean, think about it. If a bacteria can't live on it, how are you going to live on it? Right? Anyway, are there other questions or comments on our Torah portion for today? We have really gotten off track. Although the discussion has been interesting. If there's not, then... and Rip Van, very good. Thank you for that link that you gave, Mark 22:22 there. I'm going to start moving towards Yeshayahu chapter 19. That's Isaiah chapter 19. And we're going to be discussing the whole chapter. And when I get there, I'll look up and see if there's a hand up or if there's another comment in the text. And if not, then we're going to move on. Then we're going to move on. I'm sorry, I burped a little bit there. Anyway, here we go. If bugs won't eat it, it isn't food. That's right, Barak Yahoo. That's exactly right. If you can't sustain a bacteria on it, how are you going to sustain a human body on it? You can't see it. There's an argument from the lesser to the greater, or from the greater to the lesser, if you will. All right, here we're going to go to Isaiah chapter 19. I'm going to read the whole chapter. And I think we're going to comment on 1 to 10 and then stop, but we'll see. Okay, Isaiah chapter 19, Yeshayahu. The burden of Egypt. Behold, Jehovah rideth upon a swift cloud and shall come into Egypt. And the idols of Egypt shall be moved at his presence, and the heart of Egypt shall melt in the midst of it. And I will set the Egyptians against the Egyptians, and they shall fight every one against his brother, and every one against his neighbor, city against city, and kingdom against kingdom. And the spirit of Egypt shall fail in the midst thereof, and I will destroy the council thereof, and they shall seek to the idols, and to the charmers, and to them which have familiar spirits, and to the wizards. And the Egyptians will I give over into the hand of a cruel lord, and a fierce king shall rule over them, saith Adonai, Yehovah Tsevaot. And the waters shall fail from the sea, and the river shall be wasted and dried up, and they shall turn the rivers far away, and the brooks of defense shall be emptied and dried up, and the reeds and the flags shall wither. The paper reeds by the brooks, by the mouth of the brooks, and everything sown by the brooks shall wither, be driven away, and be no more. The fishers also shall mourn, and all they that cast angle into the brooks shall lament, and they that spread nets upon the waters shall languish. Moreover, they that work in fine flax, and they that weave networks, shall be confounded, and they shall be broken in the purposes thereof, all that makes sluices and ponds for fish. Surely the princes of Zoan are fools. The counsel of the wise counselors of Paro are become brutish. How say ye unto Paro, I am son of the wise, the son of ancient kings? Where are they? Where are thy wise men? And let them tell thee now, and let them know what Jehovah Tsevaot hath purposed upon Egypt. The princes of Zoan are become fools. The princes of Noph are deceived. They have also seduced Egypt, even they that are the stay of the tribes thereof. Jehovah hath mingled a perverse spirit in the midst thereof, and they have caused Egypt to err in every work thereof, as a drunken man staggereth in his vomit. Neither shall there be any work of Egypt which the head or tail, branch or rush may do. In that day shall Egypt be like unto women, and it shall be afraid and fear because of the shaking of the hand of Jehovah Tsevaot which he shaketh over it. And the land of Judah shall be a terror unto Egypt. Every one that maketh mention thereof shall be afraid in himself, because of the counsel of Jehovah Tsevaot, which he hath determined against it. In that day shall five cities of the land of Egypt speak the language of Canaan, and swear to Jehovah Tsevaot, one shall be called the city of destruction. In that day shall there be an altar to Jehovah in the midst of the land of Egypt, and a pillar at the border thereof to Jehovah. And it shall be for a sign and for a witness unto Jehovah Tsevaot in the land of Egypt, for they shall cry unto Jehovah because of the oppressors, and he shall send them a Savior, and a great one, and he shall deliver them. And Jehovah shall be known to Egypt, and the Egyptians shall know Jehovah in that day, and shall do sacrifice and oblation. Yea, they shall vow a vow unto Jehovah and perform it. And Jehovah shall smite Egypt, he shall smite and heal it. And they shall return even to Jehovah, and he shall be entreated of them, and shall heal them. In that day shall there be a highway out of Egypt to Assyria, and the Assyrian shall come into Egypt, and the Egyptian into Assyria, and the Egyptians shall serve with the Assyrians. In that day shall Israel be the third with Egypt and with Assyria. even a blessing in the midst of the land, whom Yehovah Tzevaot shall bless, saying, Blessed be Egypt, my people, and Assyria, the work of my hands, and Israel, mine inheritance. And my comments on that. Everything in this lengthy passage deals with the punishment of Egypt. By the way, I'm talking about verses 1 through 10. Everything in this lengthy passage deals with the punishment of Egypt in the darkness of the day of Yehovah. That is, I think, the last half of the time of Jacob's trouble and the time of Mashiach's arrival to physically reclaim the kingdom. But I don't think this is the punishment of Yehovah, though such punishment is determined against Egypt. I think this punishment is the oppression of the anti-Messiah in verse 4. A man of fierce countenance and all that. Or those who serve him. When Yehovah comes to Egypt, there will be those who will follow after him. For in verse 2, we'll see Egyptians fighting amongst themselves. When Yehovah comes down on the pagans of Egypt, who oppress those who follow after Yehovah, he will bring the forces of anti-Mashiach down to oppress them all. Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood government probably will be seen as too moderate in its treatment of B'nai Zion, which attitude can already be seen developing on the evening news almost nightly. When the New World Order comes down on mollycoddling Egypt, let me do that again. When the New World Order comes down on mollycoddling Egypt, they will come down hard, as related in verses 5 through 10. In verses 11 to 17, we see the counselors of Paro are fools and deceived, thus giving Paro lousy advice. They have forgotten what Yehovah did to them and their false Elohim when he brought Egypt out of bondage. Noph was the Hebrew name for the city of Memphis, Zoan for the city of Tanis in the northeastern part of the Nile Delta, which is the first city an Israelite would come to upon crossing the Egyptian border with Gaza. And we talked about this when we talked about Jeremiah a couple of months ago. This place, Zoan, was where Jeremiah ended up going. He was carried off captive in the captivity, and this is where he went to. And it's the last thing we know of that where Jeremiah was at, although tradition says that he went on and he went through Ireland and into Scotland and stuff like that. Anyway. That's all tradition. Today's princes of Noph and Zoan are, I think, the most radical elements of the Muslim Brotherhood in Cairo and on the Egyptian side of the Gaza frontier. They'll advise Paro to do what the Islamist branch of the New World Order decrees, rather than what he is inclined to do. For that reason, Yehovah is determined to hammer Egypt in verse 17. He is shaking his fist over Egypt in verse 16, but before he can bring his own wrath down, something happens. Verses 18 through 25 show us that for some reason, five cities of Egypt must repent in humility. The literal meaning of Canaan, by the way, is humility. For suddenly there is an altar to Yah in the midst of Egypt and a pillar in the border. This could be the purpose of the Great Pyramid, which is in the middle of the nation and at the border between Upper and Lower Egypt. For some fascinating speculation about its true purpose, see the book, The Great Pyramid Decoded, by E. Raymond Capt, which, by the way, we're going to be hearing YouTubes about. Rip was not able to load them into Fulfilling Torah this week, but we'll be listening to them. There are four YouTube. He's also going to give you the YouTube address so that you can go and actually watch it, and you can just mute us and you can watch that thing and comment on it as you go if you'd like. Okay, anyway, we're going to be looking at those YouTubes. The dimensions of the pyramid may prophesy Messiah in both of his appearances. This passage seems to indicate that Egypt is redeemed in the great trib, in the midst of her oppression by the fierce king of verse 4. In verse 23, Yehovah heals her after he's allowed her to be smitten by that fierce king. It also looks as if Assyria turns to Yehovah in the great trib, and she becomes one end of the king's highway. Egypt being the other end, with Israel smack dab in the middle of it. Look at what Yehovah tells these nations. My people, he calls them rather, my people, the work of mine hands, and these nations are in very enviable positions entering the messianic kingdom of Yeshua due to their willing service to him in the great trib. Here's a speculation warning. Perhaps they become safe havens for B'nai Tzion. It's a possibility. That's the end of my speculation warning on that. And that's the end of my commentary on Yeshayahu chapter 19. Questions or comments? You have a mic and you'd like to take the mic, you can just raise your hand and I will give it to you. And if not, I'll look through here for some comments in the text. Looking. You know what? That's a good point, Yoshbar. Aspartame is in a lot of things. It's a lot cheaper than sugar. It's a lot sweeter than sugar. And so they don't need to use as much of it even. So it's very good possibility that you're getting that stuff even though you don't know. You've got to be very careful about reading all the labels about what's in it. If I see something that's a low calorie or light or something like that, I don't even buy it. I don't even think about buying it. I would rather have the full calorie, full sugar stuff than any of those poisons. The only non-calorie sweetener that you can trust is stevia, and only pure stevia. Okay? It's very hard to find that stuff on the market. The FDA approved it for sale, but the companies that are putting it on the market in your grocery stores are mixing in maltodextrin and all this different stuff that is not, it's sweet, but it's not really sugar. And it adulterates the stevia. You got to be very careful about that stuff. Anyway, that's the only non-calorie sweetener that you ought to even consider using is stevia, pure stevia extract. Now, Mark 22:22 had to leave. Sorry to see that. Yeah. You grow stevia in your greenhouse. That's cool, Dumrod. I did not know that. That's very cool. Thank you. Yeah, you have your hand up and you can take the mic.
Thanks, Mark. Shabbat Shalom. Quick question. You talked about possibly a safe haven for Israel in the latter days, Egypt, Syria. I know there's a mention somewhere about Bozrah, and I think there's a mention somewhere about the Negev or somewhere in the southern part of Israel also being a safe haven. Anyways, I wanted to know if you had a biblical precedent or some prophecy in mind when you suggest that Egypt and Syria could become safe havens for Israel during the tribulation. Thanks.
Okay, I'm just going by what it says right there in that passage, and I'm actually connecting dots is all. For some reason, Zion is a problem over there, but for some reason, five cities are going to be going over to Yehovah. And that's why I'm thinking that possibly those might become safe havens for B'nai Tzion. And like I said, it's strictly speculation. Okay. Other questions? Oh, Emark, you have your hand up, and you can go ahead and take the mic.
Yeah, I actually forgot. I was actually going to comment for Mark that he took off, but if you guys see him, part of the things, because I was dealing with this too a little bit, and I had some toxic some toxins that were that I think I had to deal with. I'm actually in the process. I'm going to do the cleanse. I have never done one. Yuck. But I think it's worth it. When it was explained to me my problems, that solves just getting them toxins out. But at sugar, if you're doing too much sugar, and I tend to stay away from it. I occasionally get into the chocolate. You know, I like chocolate, but like everyone does. But I really am pretty good with not doing sweets. If it's not in front of me, I don't do it. And I, we go back to the financial end, I can live probably on a modest income, probably as low as a lot of people, except people who have their own farms who are completely self-sustaining. But I've been cheating myself a little bit on my nutrition. And spending some time with some people on the other side of Pennsylvania has really taught me I need to invest more in my nutrition. And I'm going to start doing that. But I got elderberry jam when I was over there, when you talked about elderberry. And I need to learn how to find elderberries because I know they're native almost everywhere. I get it. But anyways, by the way, I got my one last time I bought stevia was from an Amish herbalist or a Mennonite herbalist over in Bethel, PA, which is where some of my friends are over there. And I still have that. That wasn't my favorite stevia. I got believe it or not, one of the better stevias I have. I got at Whole Foods, very inexpensive, the powder. And that's, if I'm drinking tea and I want it sweet, I tend to, you know, you just get used to it not being sweet. I do. So coffee, I never use sweetener or sugar. I taste sugar in my coffee. Someone has a sweet, it tastes sick to me now because I'm used to not sugar. But I've got I've got toxins built up I've never done. I need to clean up. Sweating is great. But I was just going to tell him also, if you can deacidify, and for some reason I'm probably a little bit, you know, you can pH test your saliva or the liquid that comes out of other parts of your body. And if you pH test yourself and it's showing over certain levels of pH, there's certain minerals you can take that will help to the opposite of acidify, I think, is to basify, to lower the, raise or lower, whatever. You want to get away from acidic blood and get your pH in the opposite direction. And then cancer can't even grow. I've heard of people treating cancer with nutrition. In fact, there's a book written by, I saw her on TV, by a woman, alkaline blood, exactly. So there's a book written by a woman doctor who went that route and got rid of her breast cancer. I saw her on Dr. Oz, I think. And so, you know, the tools are there. It's just we got to stop listening to the doctors and the medical profession who profit off of people being sick and selling pharmakeia. Isn't that like a bad thing? They want to just push drugs and shots, and it, you know, because they make money. The sicker we are, the more money they make, and they don't even know what they're doing. There's a scripture where it talks about, we were just dealing with this the other day, and it wasn't applying to this, but it applies to this. They know not what Elohim, it was when Yeshua was talking to a woman, I forget which one it was, somebody. And she says, you know not what Elohim you're going after. And these people in the medical profession know not what Elohim they're following. So few of them really know the name. Yahweh, Jehovah. They don't know what they're doing. They mean well, I think, most of them. And they are pushing things that are making us sicker. Okay, let me release.
Thank you very much. There's all kinds of, you got to be really careful about what it is that you put into your body. You got to be careful about what you're buying in those grocery stores. I mean, most of the stuff on the grocery store shelves is just crap. I mean, it's just garbage. If you got to buy bread, you know, best thing you can do, if you've got to buy bread in the store, buy the double fiber stuff. It'll help to clean out your colon. That will help to make you feel better. Okay. If you don't have to buy bread, if you have a way to grind your own wheat like we do here, you don't have to worry about that kind of stuff. I get really, really good bread, really good cookies. I just finished about 90 cookies that my wife made me last week. Oh my goodness, were they ever good. We sprouted our hard white wheat And as soon as it sprouted, we put it into the Excalibur and dehydrated it, dried it down, and then put it into the mill and milled that stuff down. And I had sprouted whole wheat, whole sprouted whole wheat, nut butter, chocolate chip, seven grain cereal, craisin cookies. They were so good. Oh my goodness, were they ever good. And they're intestinal brooms, I'm here to tell you, they clean you right out. You can't do any better than that. Sorry, Sonny Patty, for taking up so much of your mic's time, so you may take it away.
I think I will move right next door to Mark so I can have some of those goodies that his wife bakes. But I have a question about the places of refuge that was talked about a little bit ago. I heard something, and I don't know how true this is, about Mount Sinai, that God had prepared, is preparing a place at Mount Sinai. Now, we know that Mount Sinai was with the children of Israel, marched around that mountain for 40 years. And what I heard is that somehow we're going to be brought back to Mount Sinai, but Mount Sinai is in Saudi Arabia, and we know what Saudi Arabia is. They're Muslims. So I just wanted to hear your take on that. Could it be possible that somehow God's going to set that region up again, as he did for the children of Israel when they were led out of Egypt? You're Mike Mark.
Thank you, Patty. And it is possible, but that's the first I've heard about Mount Sinai being a possible place of refuge. That's the first I've heard about that. That's probably somebody's speculation. And, you know, it might have good backing, at least as far as he knows, but that's the first I've ever heard of that. Someone said something about Bozrah earlier. I forget what I was thinking. Yeah, I think. And I didn't address that. Bozrah is, that's a place of judgment, I think, not refuge. I don't think that we're going to be able to take refuge there. I would have to actually look at what the guy, put forth on that. But Bozrah is, that is to goats and sheep what Chicago is to cattle and pigs. Okay? I mean, that the hog butcher of the world is Chicago. Well, that's what Bozrah is. It's a place where goats and sheep were brought for a slaughter. Meaning, and for sale. That's what that's all about. When I see Bozrah, I don't see a place of refuge. At least I have never seen it that way myself. Someone may be able to show me different, but I don't think that's the case. And as for places of refuge, these are places that, like I said again, it's speculation. I know that Yehovah is going to remove us from places where we'll be in danger for at least the 10 days of awe that lead up to Yeshua coming back to the Mount of Olives. But I don't know where that's going to be. I'm assuming that it may possibly, just from what I read in Isaiah chapter 19, that possibly one of these five cities that are going to turn to Yehovah will be those places. That's all. And that's all I really wanted to say. I told you up front that I was warning you that it was pure speculation on my part. Okay? That's stuff that's in the future, and I'm not a prophet. I'm just trying to connect dots and see if maybe this is a possibility. It's possible. And the idea of Sinai may be possible. I'd have to see what the author of the idea had to say to actually give you a decent comment on it. Okay. Are there other questions or comments on either the Torah or the Haftarah for today? That is Deuteronomy 23:19 through 24:18, and also on Isaiah chapter 19. And if there are not, I'm starting to work my way towards Psalm 139. And where's the Psalm there? Psalms 139. Okay, I'm there. Are there other questions or comments? Ah, okay. I didn't hear that. You know, I don't. This is the only time I get on Pal Talk, really and truly, is on Shabbat mornings. Very seldom am I on here. So I don't know about that. I'm busy most of the week studying so that I can, and writing my notes out so that I can pass them on to you. So, other questions or comments? No hands. I am very sorry to hear that, Rip. Father puts Scott Smith. Just raise him up before you right now, Father, and I ask that you would work miraculously in his life. That you would fix that cancer. I know you can do it. Or that you would lead him to the proper way that you want him to treat it. The cut and slash method sometimes works, but usually doesn't. And so give him other options on how he can do that. Hopefully that this cancer is in early stages and can be remitted by simple dietary change. And that would be the most wonderful thing that could happen, Father. If it's advanced, we ask that you would just heal him. You can do that, and we're asking you to go ahead and do that if that's the case. And we do this all in Yeshua's name, and for his sake, we would love to have an answer in the affirmative that it would witness in his life. Thank you, Father. Okay, Psalms 138. I'm sorry, 139. I'm not seeing any hands. Here we go. O Yehovah, thou hast searched me and known me. Thou knowest my downsitting and mine uprising. Thou understandest my thought afar off. Thou compassest my path and my lying down, and art acquainted with all my ways. For there is not a word in my tongue, but, lo, O Yehovah, thou knowest it altogether. Thou hast beset me behind and before, and laid thine hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high. I cannot attain unto it. Whither shall I go from thy spirit, and whither shall I flee from thy presence? If I ascend up to heaven, thou art there. If I make my bed in hell, behold, thou art there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there shall thy hand lead me, and thy right hand shall hold me. If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me, even the night shall be light about me. Yea, the darkness hideth not from thee, but the night shineth as the day. The darkness and the light are both alike to thee. For thou hast possessed my reins, thou hast covered me in my mother's womb. I will praise thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wondrous are thy works, and that my soul knoweth right well. My substance was not hid from thee when I was made in secret and curiously wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. Thine eyes did see my substance, yet being unperfect. And in thy book all my members were written, which in continuance were fashioned, when as yet there were none of them. Now how precious also are thy thoughts unto me, O Elohim. how great is the sum of them. If I should count them, they are more in number than the sand. When I awake, I am still with thee. Surely thou wilt slay the wicked, O Elohim. Depart from me, therefore, O ye bloody men. For they speak against thee wickedly, and thine enemies take thy name in vain. Do not I hate them, Jehovah, that hate thee? And am I not grieved with those that rise up against thee? I hate them with perfect hatred. I count them mine enemies. Search me, O Elohim, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts, and see if there be any wicked way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. Wow. So much there. So short of commentary. This psalm is comfort for those of us in exile, for it tells us that we can't be anywhere but in Jehovah's presence and thoughts. He shows us our ways, our thoughts. He is there when we walk, sit, sleep. He guards us in all our troubles. When we walk, he has the point. He has all of our flanks. He has the rear guard. We are absolutely secure as we trust him to protect us. He rejoices with us when we rejoice, and he comforts us when we mourn. And he will redeem us from our exile in his time, which grows shorter every minute. He's been right with us since we were conceived. He guided our formation in our mother's wombs. Even those of us who are not what people call perfect are formed exactly as he would have us to be. Our imperfections and abnormalities bring him glory and honor to give men a glimpse of his love and compassion for them. His thoughts toward us are awesome in their gracious mercy and in their sheer number. Remember that if he forgets us, we simply would cease to exist. Therefore, we know that he does not remember as we do, with a possibility of losing memory of us, as we do over time. When he remembers us, he brings us a blessing, even if it doesn't seem to be a blessing as it happens. For that very reason, our enemies stand no chance, though they oppress us and we have no physical means to resist. When we trust him, he takes up our cause, and there is no one who can withstand him or defeat his purpose. And that's all I've got on the psalm. Are there questions or comments on the Torah, the Haftarah, or the psalm? If you have a mic, I'm happy to give you the mic if you just raise your hand. I'm not seeing anything in the text. I'm not seeing a hand being raised. I'm moving towards Matthew chapter 5 in my Bible. And I'm moving towards verse 27, where we're going to start. And I'm looking for a hand, and I don't see one. And I'm looking for more text, and I'm not seeing it. Okay. Then we shall move on. Matthew chapter 5, verses 27 to 37. We're going to start with 27 to 30. And it goes like this. Ye have heard that it has been said by them of old time, thou shalt not commit adultery. But I say unto you that whosoever looketh on a woman to lust after her hath committed adultery with her already in his heart. And if thy right eye offend thee, pluck it out and cast it from thee. For it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish, and not that thy whole body should be cast into hell. And if thy right hand offend thee, cut it off and cast it from thee. For it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish, and not that thy whole body should be cast into hell. Okay. The spirit of the law is as important as the letter of it. I have personally never committed adultery. But Jimmy Carter and I have at least one thing in common. Each of us has lusted after women and therefore committed adultery in our hearts, according to this passage. We are not the only people to have done so by any means. This is sin in our lives every bit as much as if we performed the act. Is there any human who hasn't done this? So what is to be done? Are we all to be consigned to hell for the spiritual adultery? The fact is that Elohim would be perfectly within his rights to do just that, except for the finished work of Yeshua HaMashiach. The sin is fully paid for and has already been judged. Without the work of Yeshua, what is needed is the complete eradication of the offending organ. Better to remove the hand or eye, or in my case the brain, that offends you and enter the kingdom that be cast whole, than be cast whole into the lake of fire. How can the offending organs be removed? The remedy is given to us in Romans chapter 6 through 8. In Romans 6, we find ourselves dead to sin, but alive to Elohim in Mashiach. And we therefore need not serve sin. In Romans 7, we find that although we are dead to sin and are no longer its slaves, we yet find sin alive in our members, that is, our physical bodies. We don't have to sin, but our flesh still likes to sin. We find a constant battle being waged in our bodies, our quickened spirits wanting to live for Mashiach, and our yet-to-be-resurrected bodies wanting to live in sin. Who shall deliver me from the body of this death? Then in Romans chapter 8, we find what may be the sweetest words in all of Scripture. And they are in verse 1. There is therefore now no condemnation to them which are in Moshiach Yeshua, who walk not after the flesh, but after the Spirit. This is followed closely by Romans chapter 8 and verses 6 to 11. For to be carnally minded is death, but to be spiritually minded is life and peace, because the carnal mind is enmity against Elohim, for it is not subject to the law of Elohim, neither indeed can be. So then, they that are in the flesh cannot please Elohim. But ye are not in the flesh, but in the Spirit, if so be that the Spirit of Elohim dwell in you. Now if any man have not the Spirit of Mashiach, he is none of his. And if Mashiach be in you, the body is dead because of sin, but the Spirit is life because of righteousness. But if the Spirit of him that raised up Yeshua from the dead dwell in you, he that raised up Mashiach from the dead shall also quicken your mortal bodies by his Spirit that dwelleth in you. If the Ruach HaKodesh dwells in you, there is no condemnation any more. Do you truly wish in your heart to serve Yehovah Yeshua HaMashiach or your own lusts? The heart attitude is the telling part. Paul said in Romans chapter 7 and verse 25 that the dilemma faced him all the time, daily. He wanted to serve Yeshua with everything in his soul and spirit, but his flesh kept getting in the way. Then he tells us in Romans chapter 8 and verse 11 that even that problem is solved by the finished work of Yeshua and the indwelling Ruach HaKodesh. Our bodies will be raised incorruptible and immortal and without sin. The offending members shall be completely eradicated. What a day that will be. And I'm open to questions and comments on Matthew chapter 5, verses 7 through 30. And Sonny Patty, you have your hand up and may take the mic.
Thank you, Mark. These sins cannot only just be for men, but also for women, which is as much tempted as man is. And I found out that the less TV one watches, you're better off. Because look at the commercials that we are seeing on, you know, the commercials are just absolutely horrible and getting worse each year. And the TV shows are just as bad. You got to be so careful as to what to watch. I find myself mostly watching the Weather Channel and PBS for some of their nature shows and what have you, and void of those type of commercials. But then I noticed, too, in Facebook, I had Facebook now for quite a few years, but I'm just totally appalled by the ads that you see on your page. You can't even go into your profile page without these ads just popping up at you that are almost tempted sometimes just to delete Facebook altogether. But, you know, your eye, your eye and your ear gate, you need to be so careful as to what you are hearing and what you are seeing. And I'm to the point where I just want to hear the Word of God. You put that in my ears, and I see it with my eyes, and it's planted in my heart and in my mind. But if you're watching TV, and you're watching movies, and you're watching these commercials, what is taking into your eye gate and your ear gate? It's and then, of course, a lot of these Pal Talk rooms is just as bad. I mean, it's... We need to be so careful as to what we are seeing and what we are hearing. And I'm at that point where I'm just about ready to throw the TV out to the trash, let someone else have it. But that's where I'm standing at now. Just, and the Lord warns us, you know, be careful what you hear and what you see. Be careful. And women are just with images, and you just have to just turn your head and walk the other way. Just sometimes it's best kind of be like a horse with blinders on each side of your eyes to where you don't see. You don't see to the right, and you don't see to the left, but you're looking forward. I'm going to release the mic now.
Very good. Very good, Patty. You're exactly right. We all have these eyes that, you know, we see motion in the corners of our eyes. And it's, you see something often in one corner and you glance at it to make sure that it's not a threat, because you know, everything's a threat anymore. So, you know, you glance at everything that's going on to see if there's a threat coming at you. And, you know, sometimes it ends up being something that you don't want to take your eyes off because it really looks good. You know what I mean? So, yeah, you got to be very careful about what you let yourself dwell on. It's one thing to take a glance. I mentioned the Black Velvet billboards. The Black Velvet is some kind of a liquor. I don't even know what it is. I've never tasted this stuff. But it's a whiskey of some kind. But those things are constantly with absolutely gorgeous women dressed in black velvet and slinky. And, I see the Black Velvet ad, I turn away from it immediately. But, you know, it gets in. It's it's really difficult. Yehovah put this in us, in our physical flesh, so that we could propagate the species, you know, and then we allow it to be perverted in us, and that's the point. We need to try to get away from that deception, you know. So anyway. Hermeneutica, you have your hand up and you can take the mic. Listen, man, I'm gonna be gone for just about a minute and a half or so. I need to take another quick bio break, and I will be back shortly.
What's at issue is thought before anything else. And I learned a long time ago that if you teach a child the right thing to do, you don't have to manipulate his environment. He'll take care of it himself. And I was very successful in that attitude and policy and exercise to teach him the word. I don't rely upon other people to teach him. I didn't rely upon manipulating his environment. And as a consequence, as a 30-year-old virgin this year, he got married to another virgin. What's at issue is thought and judging one's thought before the Lord, doing it on a consistent basis. And where that thought doesn't measure up, confessing it as sin to God. Not to man, to God. If we confess our sins, he's faithful and just to forgive us our sins and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness. It's really very clear. And contrary to that is if we say we have no sin, we make him a liar and the truth is not in us. And Paul says, neither grieve nor quench the Holy Spirit by which you are sealed unto the day of redemption. So what's at issue there is enjoying that ministry. And I will wager to you that if, in fact, you make that a practice, you will see how the Holy Spirit can work in your life to deal with a lot of this kind of thing that we are indeed bombarded with daily. And in that fashion, grow in grace and the knowledge of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, and subscribe to a pastor that studies and teaches on a daily basis. I don't know what Fulfilling Torah is doing, but what else do you do that you don't do on a daily basis? Do you eat once a week? Do you sleep once a week? Do you bathe once a week? Do you go to work once a week? Yeah, but the Word of God is taught once a week. Nonsense. It's got to be daily. Daily, daily, daily. That's the washing and the renewing of the Word, which is a process. Growing is a process. Growing grace and the knowledge of our Lord and Savior is a process. You don't just do it once a week. Okay, whoever else wants to talk, talk.
Thank you, Hermeneutica. Very good. You're correct. You got to be in the Word every day. Every day, you got to. And you know, I'll spend probably two whole days this week just preparing for next week. Next week's Shabbat service. It may go longer than that. I don't know. But, I won't even check my email for at least two or three days until I'm done studying for next week. So, you know, if you send me an email and I don't answer you before Thursday, it's because I'm busy. anyway, Sandy. You spell it exactly the same way. It's Sandy Patty was with a TTI, you know. Anyway, Sunny Patty. You may have the mic.
Well, she is a great singer, Sandy Patty. But no, I'm Sunny. And it's Sunny because some people in Pell Talk has always called me Sunny. Because when I got into a room, there was usually three, four Patties. And three of us was in Kansas. And so to determine who's who, I got the nickname Sunny, Sunny Patty. So that's how come I chose that. But I wanted to, some time ago, I've been now in this room for a little over a year. I believe I started in December, around the middle of December last year. And so I've been in here for a year. And I've been enjoying it. A few times I kind of wanted to leave and never come back, but I kind of put my foot down and said, I'm going to stay. But you got into a teaching some time back on the tzitzit, and I got to studying that, and do women wear those? And the answer was yes. Okay, I wanted a prayer shawl in the worst way. And one time in my church, a lady had prayed over me, and she saw me with a covering over my head going towards a chuppah. And I thought, oh, wow. And she asked me if I owned a prayer shawl or a tzitzit, and I said, no, I don't. And she says, well, you're going to get one. And I thought, well, I don't wonder how this is going to happen, because I looked at the prices, and there's no way I could afford it. So I thought, I'm going to do something really special for myself. I'm going to make me one. And so I did. And when I sit down, and there's something really awesome about this. When I open up the Word, I put this over my head, and it's so pretty. I made this myself, and it's so pretty. And there's a tassel, blue tassel, that hangs down. And I open the Word, and I read the Word, and I pray. Because when I pray, I also pray the Scriptures. As a Scripture comes across my mind, I pray that Scripture towards my family, towards myself, towards my church. And there was just something really about that that I think is just so awesome. I just feel like I'm just so being so blessed. I used to fight against a prayer shawl, really tooth and toenail. People tell me, oh, do you wear a head covering? Do you wear a prayer shawl? And I used to really fight against it. But now I see the blessing in it. I really wanted to share that with the room. And, yeah, it is pricey. And maybe one day I will get one, but I save up my money for one. But meantime, the little one that I made is, I think, is really pretty and really sweet. And I just wanted to share that. You're my...
That is wonderful, Patty. Wonderful. Yeah, you don't have to have a 6-foot by 4-foot talit, you know. That's a talit gadol, you know, a great talit. You don't have to have anything like that. It doesn't have to be made out of wool. It doesn't have to be made out of linen. It doesn't have to be made out of anything like that. If you want to go and get yourself some nice cotton and make yourself a cotton, what difference does it make what it's made out of? There's nothing in the Scripture that says it has to be made out of this or that. You know, the reason that Zipporah Rachel deals with linen is because linen is one of the best fabrics that you can have around you. It and wool are the best things that you can wear, because of the electrical properties of that thing and how it relates to your body. I mean, it's just really good stuff that actually helps to heal your body. Wool and linen each do the same thing in different ways. And therefore, one of the reasons that I can think of that Yehovah says not to put wool and linen together is because they counteract each other. The electrical charges or properties counteract each other, and they don't do you any good. But if you got one or the other, it works great. So, anyway, the tzitzit just says that it needs to be tehelet, which means blue, basically. The Stone's edition of the Tanakh says tehelet is turquoise blue. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. It's a tradition that the tehelet has to be made from a certain kind of snail and a snail shell, and that shell has to be broken at a particular time of day so that it will turn blue. If you do it at another time of day, it'll turn purple. I mean, there's all this stuff, and you know, they say that we don't use blue in the thing because we don't have the snail, and we're not, you know, we don't have it's a bunch of garbage. They just are not following Torah when they're using all white talitot. It doesn't say anything about what makes the color blue. Okay, you can have just blue dye. You know, and it can be color fast so that it doesn't ever wear off or wash out. You can have a nice, any kind of string that you want. It just says that you have a ribbon of blue in it. It doesn't matter what color all the rest of the stuff is. I got four different colors in my tzitzit, okay, and it happens to be the four different colors that are in a traditional army fatigue camouflage fatigue, and I got a blue ribbon through a blue thread through it, okay. So it looks, you know, that's just because that's what I wanted to do. That stuff doesn't make any difference. As long as you've got that ribbon of blue in there, you're following Torah. You know? Yes, the use of wool and linen was strictly for the priests. They had a linen undergarment under their woolen vestures. Okay, we'll call it vestures. I grew up in the Catholic Church, so, you know, when I was a kid, so vesture comes to mind. Their vestments, their whatever you want to call it. That's the ephod, the tunic that he wore was made from the same material as the Mishkan, the tabernacle, okay, and it was woven in the same way, and it had wool, three different colors of wool, fine linen, and metallic gold threads woven all together, and those are the only things that were supposed to be made for that, from those ingredients, okay, that's the only thing that was supposed to be made like that. And we were not to make something that was similar to it. And so, yeah, that's exactly right. The priests had that particular thing that they wore while they were working in the Mishkan and in the Mikdash as well, the temple. So yeah, that's all well taken. I'm only saying that the physical reason to not wear the two together is because they counteract. Their electrical properties counteract each other, okay? And it's as if you're not wearing either, you know? Not that it's going to hurt you to do that, but he's told us not to wear that, and there's a reason for it. And that's the physical reason I can think of, and the spiritual reason is because that's reserved specifically to the priest, okay? And that's the Aharonic priest. So, Emark, you got your hand up, and you can take the mic.
Me? Okay, hold on a second. I was actually just talking to a sister, but hold on, is the mic locked? Oh, wow, it locked itself. I forgot. Oh, we were talking about the tzitzit. So the answer to the question, and I apologize, I didn't pay attention. Give me a one if you guys can hear me, because I'm not sure how my mic came on. I bind my tassels with a thread, a cord of blue. And I think that's the way we're supposed to do it. And I didn't see, that's what I read, I didn't see commandments specifically for a prayer shawl, but what's nice about that, I got my first prayer shawl a little bit ago, actually, when my father passed away. Ironically, in the Jewish tradition, you get a prayer, you get a type it in for me, Mark, because you know the Jewish word for it. I forget. You get a, what's it called? What are they called? You get it when you get bar mitzvah. And it has tassels. It has little tassels in the end of it, but then you can attach four white tassels, which is what the Jews. I'm half Judah and my bloodline and half a Talit, exactly. Talis is what they call it, actually. And I'm half Levite, actually, from Aaron's descendants. I'm half Cohen on my mother's side. So, and in any event, but I don't see a commandment to have it. But what's nice, that was a garment for them. And the real big long ones are worn. My little, I don't have the real big one. I got it actually when my father passed away. This is a very interesting story, and I think this is worth spending a little time. When my father passed away, they offered to put a tallit on him, but he never got bar mitzvah either. And I put tassels on his suit. We buried him in a suit, which I'm not sure was the perfect thing to do. I, by the way, I don't know if I told you this, Mark, but I David Cohen suggested that I go speak to a Hasidic rabbi. And those guys are so much different than the Judaism I was exposed to as a child. If I would have been with those guys, I might have been hanging out in those places long ago. But I think Yah had this path in store for me. But so we got him a kosher casket, which is very interesting. I can talk to you about that another time. But they offered a tallit. Some of this is tradition, but some of it isn't. The tallit they were going to put on him. But I said, you know what? I don't have one. I wouldn't mind. Would you mind if I have it? They said, fine. You like pay one price and everything's included except for some extra special. And it's all way too much money, but that's another thing. So I have a tallit. And then David taught me how to put the white ones on and then attach the colored ones to the white ones. So I have on my garment a fringe. As long as I have a fringe with a blue cord wrapped around my fringe, I think I'm filling Torah. And as long as I put it on the corners of my garment, the boundaries of my garment. So what I feel is appropriate for me is I put two on my belt loops. And I like to have them a little bit in the front so they shouldn't be a burden. And I can feel them and they remind me. And then I actually like to put two on my top garment, which is also a boundary, which I wear a fleece a lot of times. And I put them on my zippers and they make it easy to get the zippers up and down. Actually, they're pretty cool. We used to do that when we used to teach skiing. They used to make little tabs so you could grab it with your gloves. But I don't ski that much anymore because I got a plate in my arm. But I got tassels on my upper garment, too. So I end up wearing four usually, sometimes a few more. I put one on my guitar case. I hang them in my on my a lamp every once in a while because it reminds me I should be keeping the commandments. But in the belt loops. But here's the deal. You should attach them to your garment, and I'll tell you why that's a blessing. I don't know if I shared with you. I used to safety pin them, which a lot of people do, onto pants, especially pants that don't have belt loops. I, by the way, over in my other room, am waiting to find a thread and needle, and I need my glasses because I can't even see the thread and needle now, to attach them permanently to these pants. And here's why. If you don't attach them and you safety pin them, you get cursed. And I'll tell you how you get cursed. When you bend over and sit down and that safety pin comes undone and stabs you in your mid regions, it ain't pleasant. That's a curse. So I like to put them on my belt loops and attach them permanently, or I'm going to sew them. And I've done that, I think, on one pair of shorts so far. And if I can thread a needle, I figured that was good work to do in the Sabbath because that's sort of above God, but maybe not. I can't find my glasses, so it ain't happening today anyways. Oh, see, someone else got stabbed with the needle. And, you know, I learned by example. I'm like I'm a stiff-necked one. You know, I think that's what they said about Judah. I'm stiff-necked, all of Israel, right? We're all stiff-necked. So for me, I got to get stabbed a few times in my nether regions before I learn I ought to just follow the commandments and attach them. And I was so blessed. I had a sister who made tassels. And she left me. She stayed here for quite a while, actually a long time, where it actually got to be a little bit difficult for both of us. But she didn't have any money. I didn't ask her for any money. It was a blessing for me to have her here. And she actually helped me through the time of my father's passing. And I actually have tassels on my father that she made. And she was blessed to be able to have those and see how important that was to me and my family. Because my dad's going to wake up one day, he's going to look down and say, wow, look at these tassels. These are pretty. Mark used to wear these. I know what these are about because I told him. And the blessing that I had in my father, I feel guilty about a lot of things. He passed a couple years ago that I didn't get to spend as much time. But he saw a change in me. And, Mark, I have you to thank a lot for that because you helped me in my walk more than you ever know. That he saw the change in me that allowed him to understand that maybe there was something. He knew it. He said he made a statement in his will that blew us all away because he was never religious. He was an atheist, as I was for most of my life. And he said, I'm trying to think of the exact words. He said, thank God for me being blessed to have such wonderful children and family. In his will, which is a very odd, the lawyer looked at it and said, I've never seen someone put the statement like this in the will when they read the will. And I'm sorry, this is very emotional for me. It made me feel so wonderful because I know it was not just me, because all of us kids, I may be the only one who knows the name and understands the way that I do, but all of us children have come to an understanding that of Yah existence in some way or another. And I might be further along the path, who knows, maybe not. Maybe they just don't know the name, but my brothers and sisters are further along in different ways. But the blessing to me is that through my walk and through my example that I set and just saw my life change 180 degrees. If it could change more than 180, it was more. And I think that's the ultimate blessing. And when I think back of all the shortcomings that I had in my relationship with my father, the blessing that Yah provided to me, because I didn't do this, to be able to show the light of him through me to bring my father to understand that he's real. And when he wakes up, he's going to have tassels on him. And he's going to say, wow, I know what these are about. Where's my son? Where's Yah? Where's Yeshua? Because that's at that point, he's going to get to really get his learning started. So sorry, I don't even know what I was going to start saying. I was talking about the DT stuff, but I'm going to release the mic. And then, my feelings are you don't need a prayer shawl. You just need to wear tassels. That's what you commanded to do. The prayer shawl has four tassels on it. It's pretty cool. And that garment, and that one, by the way, is so special to me because I got it. This is the closure of what I was going to start to say. I became an adult, a man, and that's the Jewish tradition. You become a man at 13. You too could be a man at 13. I didn't actually get mitzvahed. And in mikvah dedication, I dedicated myself to Yah when he first revealed himself to me. But I did not become mikvah and dedicate myself for several years after because I knew that was an important step for me. But when I got my prayer shawls, when my father passed away and I became now the man of the family, and I do believe I'm the spiritual leader of our family, as well as the other leadership positions that I filled. And it's ironic that even though the Jewish traditions sometimes don't fit and they don't wear the right tassels and stuff, but it's ironic. It's some of those traditions are pretty cool. And I got my prayer shawl when I stood up to be a man, and I'm just starting that walk right now. So that's sort of a personal note. But I think the most important thing is just we wear tassels. That's the commandment. A fringe bounded by a blue thread, and I do the best I can in the color as I know, and I think Yah's cool with that. I hope, I pray. If not, he'll forgive me. Release the mic.
Thanks, Mark. Very good. Yeah, the commandment is to have the fringe on the corners of your garments. Okay? And that's in Numbers chapter 15. And I think verse 31. Anyway, it's to have the and that the fringe have, I'm sorry, that the fringes have a ribbon of blue. And that's the commandment. I look at the corners as the corners of your garment the same way that I see corners of the earth. I put them front left, front right, rear left, rear right, around my belt loops. And I won't buy a pair of, pants that don't have at least 7 belt loops on them. And that's specifically so that I can have it on the four corners. And, they're making slacks now with only 5 belt loops, and that doesn't make any sense to me. So I won't buy those. First of all, they don't hold up your pants as well. And second of all, I can't put them on my four corners. Now, if you have a prayer shawl, my son, Daniel, wears a tallit katan. And he wears his tzitzit under his outer garments. Okay? That's something that a lot of people do. I don't have a problem with that either, but it's there to remind us. And I personally think that we should wear them on the outside so that people can see them and say, "Hey, what's that stuff that you got hanging off your? What's that all about?" So that you can have an opportunity to tell people about the hope that's in you. So I think that's a secondary reason for it being there, so that you'll have a reason to tell people about the hope that is within you. Anyway, are there other questions or comments on the first verse of our Matthew chapter 5, verses 27 to 30? Okay, and we're going to move on to 31 and 32. It hath been said. Notice it doesn't say, you have heard that it hath been said. It hath been said. Whosoever shall put away his wife, let him give her a writing of divorcement. That's our Torah portion for today, 24:1-4. But I say unto you that whosoever shall put away his wife, saving for the cause of fornication, causeth her to commit adultery, and whosoever shall marry her that is divorced committeth adultery. For this purpose, I mean, we gotta keep the context here. Whosoever shall marry her that is divorced for the cause of fornication is committing adultery. Okay, Webster's 1828 dictionary defines adultery as a violation of the marriage bed, a crime or a civil injury which introduces or may introduce into a family a spurious offspring. And it defines fornication as the incontinence or lewdness of unmarried persons, male or female. Also, the criminal conversation of a married woman with a married man with an unmarried woman. The difference between the two is the difference of the marriage relationship of the woman. This sets the limits to the writing of divorcement. Saving for the cause of fornication refers to sexual misconduct of the woman before her consummation of her marriage and her consummation thereof. In the biblical and Hebraic perspective, during the betrothal period, which is when the marriage is legal but has not yet been consummated. Adultery has to do with the conduct of a married woman. The sexual misconduct of a man is fornication unless the woman is married. If the woman is married, the man is also committing adultery. Once a marriage is finalized, divorce is not a biblical option for the believer, in my opinion, the way that I read this text. The passage that deals with the believer and divorce is 1 Corinthians chapter 7, and I'm going to refer to the verses there, but I'm not going to actually read them. The passages in 1 Corinthians chapter 7 are verses 1 through 17, verse 20, verse 27, and verse 39 and 40. These deal with the leaving spouse, or rather with leaving a spouse or putting a spouse away. The main context speaks of avoiding fornication by marrying, if the person is burning with lust. Then he goes on to say, Paul goes on to say, that once the marriage is entered into, one should not leave or put away his or her spouse. To do so is to cause the other party to become an adulterer or adulteress, as we see in Matthew chapter 5. Paul tells them that he would rather they not marry and give themselves to the service of Yehovah, but also says that if they cannot control their passions, they should marry. There is no sin in marriage, but there is in fornication and adultery. Taking these two passages together, along with Romans 7, we see that there is no scriptural grounding for divorce. There is no injunction, thou shalt not divorce, although Elohim does say, I hate putting away. For this reason, I think, italicized I think, denotes an educated guess, and I may be wrong, but I doubt it. For this reason, I think that divorce itself is not the sin, but the accompanying lust and almost inevitable carnality and adultery is sinful. As far as Yehovah is concerned, the marriage is never dissolved, just as the union of Yeshua to the believer and the believer's assembly is never broken. Marriage is the practical picture of the relationship between Mashiach and his body. Ephesians chapter 5 has much to say about the husband and the wife being representative of Mashiach and the assembly, and how each should relate to the other. As the assembly is to submit to Yeshua, so the wife is to submit to her husband. And as Yeshua loves his body and gave himself for her, so should the husband love his wife and give himself for her. If you look at Philippians chapter 2, verses 3 through 8, you can see the proper attitude of married couples. Verse 3, let nothing be done through strife or vain glory, but in lowliness of mind let each esteem other better than themselves. Look not every man on his own things, but every man on the things of others. Let this mind be in you, which was also in Moshiach Yeshua, who being in the form of Elohim thought it not robbery to be equal with Elohim, but made himself of no reputation, and took upon him the form of a servant, and was made in the likeness of men. And being found in fashion as a man, he humbled himself, and became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. Consider the relationship between Yeshua and the assembly from another angle. He is the only begotten son of Elohim, while we are the adopted sons of Elohim. As the adopted children in an earthly family, they have the same rights as the natural children, so we have the same standing in heaven as Yeshua, being joint heirs with him. Galatians chapter 4 and verse 7 says this, wherefore thou art no more a servant, but a son, and if a son, then an heir of Elohim through Mashiach. And then in Romans chapter 8 and verse 17 it says, and if children, then heirs, heirs of Elohim and joint heirs with Mashiach, if so be that we suffer with him, and we may be also glorified together. And so we, the wife, are joint heirs with Yeshua, the husband. We are on equal footing before Elohim in Yeshua. So is the wife equal to the husband in the earthly marriage. As Yeshua is the head of the body, so the husband is the head of the wife. As the body cannot function without the head, and the assembly cannot function without Yeshua, HaMashiach, so the family, the marriage, cannot properly function without the husband. The wife submits to her husband as he submits to Yeshua, as he submits to the Father, not as a matter of one being better than the other, but as a matter of need for some chain of authority. The buck has to stop somewhere. And as Yeshua is the authority, head over the body, and is responsible for her, so the husband is the authority, the head over his wife, and is responsible for her. And therefore, the buck stops with the husband. The kahal, or church, even takes on the name of Yeshua HaMashiach. We are Christians, Christians, or Messiahniks. So the wife takes the name of her husband. This signifies that she is identifying herself with her husband. She is as immersed in him as we are immersed in the Ruach HaKodesh at our conversion and the water at our baptism or mikvah. To rend that spiritual reality by divorce paints a truly ugly picture of a headless, Mashiach-less assembly and a Ruach HaKodesh with no ministry. Does this mean that a divorced person has no standing in the assembly or before Elohim? Elohim forbid. To say that just because I may have sinned, and I emphasize may have, I am no longer saved or am living in a sinful state or condition, is the same as saying that I am no longer a Christian or a messianic because I lied to the cop about how fast I was going. The consequences of each action is different, but in the eyes of Elohim they are the same. They fall short of his righteous standard, and they are worthy of death. In Romans 6:23a, for the wages of sin is death. Every sin ever committed is paid for. None are unredeemed. In Romans chapter 6 and verse 10, for in that he died unto sin once. But in that he liveth unto Elohim. And in Hebrews chapter 10, verses 10 through 12, by the which will, we are sanctified through the offering of the body of Yeshua HaMashiach once for all. And every priest standeth daily ministering and offering oft times the same sacrifices which can never take away sins. But this man, after he had offered one sacrifice for sins forever, sat down at the right hand of Elohim. But the forgiveness needs to be claimed and received by repentance and confession. Let's say for the sake of argument that divorce itself is a sin, no matter your spiritual condition before the divorce. If you were divorced 10 years ago, and you and your spouse married previously unmarried people, and have kids by those marriages, are you both in a state of sin until you remarry each other? Are you to insist on destroying two marriages and families to make it all right? Can you deny fellowship to either family because of this? If so, whatever happened to grace? Can the person who is divorced be reconciled to Elohim? If so, why can't he be reconciled to the body of Mashiach? And if not, why not? If your position is that you are in sin until the new marriages are dissolved and the original marriage is reinstated, how about all that stuff you stole when you were a kid, or the lust you had last week, or the time you lied to get ahead? Do you have to go back and confess to each individual you stole from, or lied to, or lusted after, and make reparations so that you can get right with Elohim? If that is what you think, you are in bondage. There is no grace in your life. Only bondage to the law. 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 39, and Romans chapter 7 and verse 2 speak to this. Don't get caught up in the letter without discerning the spirit of what's there. You are bound to your spouse as long as that spouse lives. But the context of Romans 7 is the death we died in Mashiach to the law of sin in Romans 6:23a. Wages of sin is death. We are dead, buried, and resurrected with Yeshua. Dead and buried to sin and raised to life in Elohim through Mashiach. Once our sin is confessed and repented of, it is dead and buried, though the consequences of our actions still need to be dealt with, possibly. In other words, we bear our iniquity. We now have liberty to live in and for Yeshua. So cast off the bonds of sin and live in Mashiach Yeshua. And that's all I've got on verses 31 and 32. And if there are questions or comments, I'm willing to entertain the questions. Or if you have a mic and you'd like to get on, you may raise your hand and I'll be happy to give it to you. Okay. I'm not seeing any questions or comments. Before 2:30, it could be. We only have one more passage to look at. If there are questions or comments, I'm more than happy to give up the mic or address anything that might be. So what if the wife doesn't submit herself? The wife doesn't submit herself, she has to deal with the consequences of that sin. Okay? She has to deal with the consequences of that sin. So? And if she doesn't submit herself, then it's going to be very hard for the children to submit themselves. It's not good. And yes, you pray for her big time. Yeah. Because she needs to do that. When we're talking about submission, we're not talking about being a doormat. You know, the husband doesn't get to walk all over her. You know, I mean, she's an equal partner in the deal. Okay, she just needs to understand that final authority is his. It's that simple. Final authority is the husband's, and if he refuses to exercise it, she ought not exercise it for him. It's very difficult for people to do. Yeah. Okay. Remember, fornication is before the marriage is consummated. Up to 70 times 7, Daryl? That I cannot answer you. If adultery? Maybe 10,000. Maybe. It might take that. Wow, 10,000. I can't imagine anybody ever being able to commit adultery 10,000 times. Wow, that's a lot. But I don't. Yeah. Well, you know what? If I don't know what to tell you. What I can tell you is this: once a divorce happens, and you know, you there isn't a whole lot you can do about it. You know, especially if that person goes on to somebody else, there isn't a whole lot you can do about it. So, at that point, you know, you forgive yourself and ask God to forgive you, and that's really all it should take. He'll forgive you. All you got to do is admit it, and you know, the sin is taken care of. It's already been paid for. You know, that sin is buried and dead and buried rather, and you're alive. So, you know, confess it and be done with it, and forgive the one that's wronged you. Yeah, that'll take care of your spirituality, I think. Dust off your feet. Exactly right. Other questions or comments? If not, we'll move to the last five verses, 33 to 37. Is it wrong to marry a divorced man? It's wrong for a divorced man to remarry the wife that he has divorced. Okay? That's Torah, Devarim chapter 24 and verses 1 to 4. The man is the one that's precluded from marrying the first wife again. Okay? According to Torah. Okay, I'm rolling to Matthew chapter 5 and verse 33 37. What about the wife he divorced? According to Devarim chapter 24, she can go ahead and marry another man. Okay? Now, if a man divorces his wife for a cause other than fornication, and that fornication is, again, that's done during the betrothal period, and once the marriage is consummated, it becomes adultery. But he's not supposed to divorce her over adultery, according to what Yeshua said in our passage just a little bit ago. Fornication is the only reason for that divorce is okayed by Yeshua himself. And I think that's a good reading of the Torah portion. You understand that when the betrothal period begins in the Hebrew way of thinking, once they're betrothed, they are married. Okay, that's a legal action, and there has to be a divorce in order for that to end, and that has to happen before the marriage is consummated. Okay. And I think that's probably what Moshe was talking about in Devarim chapter 24. Because that's what Yeshua makes the issue. Okay, let me give you the definition right from, this is from Webster's 1828 dictionary. Where are you? Here you are. Adultery is the violation of the marriage bed a crime or a civil injury which introduces or may introduce into a family a spurious offspring. Fornication is the incontinence or lewdness of unmarried persons, male or female, also a criminal conversation of a married man with an unmarried woman. And so the difference between the two is the married state of the woman. Okay, whether she is in betrothal period, that's fornication. If it's in a consummated marriage, that's adultery. Okay? That's the way that I understand it. And we're moving now to 533 through 37. Again, ye have heard that it hath been said by them of old time, thou shalt not forswear thyself, but shalt perform unto Jehovah thine oaths. We read that today too, didn't we? But I say unto you, swear not at all, neither by heaven, for it is Elohim's throne, nor by the earth, for it is his footstool, neither by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Neither shalt thou swear by thy head, because thou canst not make one hair white or black. But let your communication be yes and no. For whatsoever is more than these comes of evil. In these next few passages, Yeshua gives a few examples of what he means and then gives the principle of what to which the law refers. Don't swear by something you can't control. And just what is it that you can control? Nothing. So don't swear by something. So don't swear at all. Just be honest in your words and dealings. Be the type of person that everyone knows does what he says he'll do. No one can ask more of anyone than that, and no one will if you are honest in your dealings with them, unless, of course, they can't be trusted themselves. The Greek word behind evil is poneros. There are two words translated evil in the New Testament, this one and kakos. Kakos means bad or disjointed, hence the word cacophony, as in a bad sound, like the rock band Devo, or any grunge band. That's kakos, okay? That's cacophony. What Yeshua is saying is that anything other than being truthful is wicked, straight out of the fleshly heart of man, which is deceitful and desperately wicked, according to Jeremiah 17:19. So, to summarize, it seems that the divorced woman who marries another man is not committing adultery, but the man who marries her is. As we saw in the Torah today, the woman is not precluded from more than one marriage. If her husband ends the marriage with a writ of divorce, even though he may not take her to wife again once she has consummated the second marriage. It is interesting that Yeshua uses this passage as an illustration of his parable about cutting off your right hand if it offends you. It may be the very thing we needed, or rather he needed to say to his Talmudim before they left their homes to follow him. If they were married, they had no right to divorce their wives or to just leave them without providing for them. If they were not married, it would be better to remain that way, if they were going to follow him. Now, I don't know about the rest of you, but my wife is definitely my right hand. Nothing of any importance gets done without her. Yeshua is telling these men that only if their wives are guilty of fornication are they allowed to cut them off. Otherwise, the husband is causing her adultery. He is guiltier than she. Another application is this. Don't pledge yourself to anything that you're not certain you can deliver, but be a man of your word. See also Deuteronomy chapter 23, 21 to 23, Deuteronomy 24, 14 and 15 from today's Torah portion. The marriage ketubah, or betrothal contract, is every bit as serious as a vow to Yehovah. That, I think, is the point of him putting Deuteronomy 24 where he did, to emphasize the idea that your vow to her is the same as a vow to Yehovah. Okay, that's all I got. End of the Bible study. Questions or comments? Till death by stoning shall you part. Very good, Barak Yahu. Okay. Well, I'm not seeing any questions or comments. And so, we'll declare this Bible study over and done. We did it in 3.5 hours, looks like, roughly. And, okay, so we'll close with a Aharonic benediction, and I'll wish you all a Shavuot Tov. See you here again next week, Yehovah willing, and the creek don't rise. Here's the benediction. Yevarechecha Yehovah vayishmorecha. Ya'ir Yehovah panav elecha. Vayichunecha. Yesa Yehovah panav elecha. Ve'yasem lecha shalom. V'shem Yeshua Moshienu sar shalom. May Yehovah bless you and keep you. May Yehovah make his face to smile upon you and be gracious unto you. May Yehovah lift up his countenance upon you and grant you his peace. In the name of Yeshua our Messiah, our Prince of Peace. Amen ve'omen.